We're going to get started. We're not quite at quorum yet, but we will be soon. And so I do nonetheless want to keep our agenda moving here. We do have one or two formal actions that we want to take in relative to the minutes, but we'll wait until we have a quorum. And I guess I actually really can't call us to order until we have a quorum. So let me do this. Let me just do a few very brief, quick initial statements and thoughts. And then we're going to move right into the agenda. And at whatever point we're at quorum, I'll call us into a formal hearing, and then we'll proceed from there. So my name is Carlos Stadiani, State Representative from St. Paul. And I have the privilege of chairing the House Committee on Education Policy. And I want to thank everyone for being here today, for the community members here in the East Metro area. And also I want to thank the presence of my colleagues from the Minnesota House. Some of you have traveled a little bit of a distance to be here, so I greatly appreciate that. A little bit later, I'm going to quickly go around and ask members to introduce themselves. But I'll do that once we kind of have a more of a critical mass here with us. Very quickly, restrooms are off to your right. There's an immediate one right off to the right, a unisex restroom. And then if you go down a little bit further off to the right again, there's a boys and girls restroom. I want to thank the East Metro Integration District Superintendent Janet Moore, who's here with us, and we'll hear from her a little bit later. Thank you for hosting as the district this hearing. I also want to thank the Crossman School for the physical hosting of this hearing. And I want to acknowledge Brian Pass, who is the superintendent, who I see walking in and out, and we're going to hear a little bit from him as well a little bit later. And of course, thank you for the parents, students, and staff, and community members that surround the Crosswind School for inviting us and for hosting us and setting up the room and making us as comfortable as possible. We look forward to hearing from a number of you soon. Let me just say, and I may have to repeat this a little bit later, for members, there is an expense reimbursement form. It's a blue form you'll find in your packet. Please fill that out so that we'll cover the expenses for this meeting. Including our taco bar, that we'll have. And what time are we doing that? 11:45? 12:30. All right, 12:30. So my staff will nudge me, and I'll alert folks so that the taco's on hold once it's served. So let me just very quickly share my interest in this issue and why I've asked the committee to come and convene at Crosswinds. As many of you know, the whole issue of this particular school and the Harambe School was a hot topic issue at the very end of session. It was one of the final kind of unfinished, not kind of, really was an unfinished bit of business that we didn't get to at the end of session. It created quite a bit of heartburn and concern. And so I thought that it was critically important for us not to let that conversation just sort of filter away, because it'll come back next session. And also because this community is continuing to discuss the decisions surrounding both this school. But more importantly, members, or just importantly, I should say, the discussion is one that has to do with the future of integration, the Integration Revenue Program, the integration approach that the state has invested in well over a couple of decades here. I thought it was really important for us then to, and then is this on? Do I need to switch it on?
That helps.
Good. Should I start over?
Yeah, right.
And so I thought let's begin that conversation. We'll continue to have this conversation throughout the interim and into the next session as well. But what, I couldn't think of a better place to have that conversation than out here in the community. And members, I'm thinking and I'm hoping that we may be able to extend that conversation out into your communities as well. So let me know if it's of interest to you as legislators from those communities. So the order of the agenda today then is to begin with just sort of a quick staff presentation of just sort of just the facts, the explicit facts that have led to both this building and our approach to in general to the Integration Revenue Program, what were the latest attempts this last legislative session to legislate around this. Then we're going to hear a broader message around the compelling state interest that has been articulated and acted upon by the state over the last couple of years. And so what I'm trying to do is make sure that we set a really good context here of what are the factual decisions that have led to this magnet school delivery of integration efforts, as well as to have a quick conversation about what the public policy considerations are for that. In other words, what is the compelling state interest that has driven the state of Minnesota to invest its time and resources in K-12 integration efforts? And then we want to hear from the community here at Crosswinds to talk about how you've manifested that compelling state interest in delivering an education experience, and whether that's been good, whether that's been bad, what are the lessons that we draw from that, what are the suggestions that it may mean, that it may offer in terms of future work for integration. And of course, the new context there is that this year the legislature redesigned the integration program and did a very aggressive, assertive move toward combining strong expectations of both racial integration and academic achievement as necessary outcomes of the state's investment in this program. And then we're going to finish by hearing from the EMED governance structure their thoughts along the same lines. So with that, I think I am now going to say I did a good stalling job. I think I am going to ask our members to introduce themselves. And so very quickly, if you just tell us who you are and the community you represent. And we have more folks coming in, so I'll start with Representative Keel. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I'm Representative Keel. I'm District 1B, and I hail from the five great south of the state, about 80 miles.
And Representative Keel and members, unless we get a gopher to run this around the microphone, we're going to have to really project, I guess. Is that correct, folks back there? Okay, very well. So
she said she's from North Dakota.
That is actually what she said.
Yeah. She's bringing the oil money with her. Yes. Actually, that if you would help us with that, Aaron, if you want. Okay. Sure, why not?
Clarify.
Clarify that you're not in North Dakota.
So. Okay. I will do that. Hi, I'm Deb Keel. I'm from District 1B, which is just south of the Canadian border, and on the North Dakota border is what I said.
East of the North Dakota border.
But I am east of North Dakota, if this is correct. I represent Polk, Red Lake, and most of Pennington counties. So, thank you.
I'll just go ahead. I'm Representative Krisha, and the district I represent is Central Minnesota, 9B, Morrison and Todd County, Little Falls. If you've been to Royalton, you know where Treasure City is. That's my area. My background is education. I've been in and out of education. I also started an online learning company, and then from there have started in economic development. So I'm very familiar with many of the issues that you folks see in education.
Representative David Bly from Northfield, Minnesota, and I am a retired 30-year veteran teacher.
My name is Joe Schoeny. I am DFL Research Consultant in the House for Education.
I'm Tim Strom. I'm a staff person with House Research.
Jody Withers, Research for Republican Caucus.
Sandra Erickson, and I represent East Central Minnesota. So when you travel to Lake Mille Lacs, you're traveling right through the heart of my district. I too, am a retired high school English teacher.
I'm Jim Maloney. I'm a committee legislative assistant for the Education Policy Committee.
So we'll hear from me again in a few minutes.
Shannon Patrick, committee administrator.
I'm Kathy Breiner, and I represent Mankato in the House, and I was a school board member for 12 years before I was a legislator, so I spent a lot of time in schools, and issues of diversity are very near and dear to my heart and my community, so I look forward to the day.
Lisa Larson, House Research Staff.
Representative Peter Fisher, I represent the communities of Maplewood, Oak, parts of White Bear Lake, Birchwood, Montemite, and Willardy. Harambee is my district. My background a little bit, I currently work at a homeless youth shelter in North Minneapolis serving youth between the ages of 16 to 21. So I see a lot of diversity issues on a regular basis.
I'm Representative Jim Dabney. I represent part of South Minneapolis in the Minnesota House and spent 17 years teaching middle school social studies.
And I'm Representative Anna Wills, and I live in Apple Valley and represent Northern Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Coates.
I'm Representative Dean Erdahl. Represent 18A, which is Meeker County, one township in Wright County, and three townships in McLeod, including the city of Hutchinson. If you've gone to see the largest ball of twine made by one man in Darwin, you're in my district. And I was a high school, middle school teacher for 35 years at New London Spicer. Currently co-chair of Secretary Ritchie, the Minnesota Civil War Commemoration Task Force, which brought me to Gettysburg last week, which led to poison ivy.
Stay away.
I'm Barbara Russo. I represent Arden Hills, Moundsview, Shoreview, and a small part of Spring Lake Park. I'm a retired high school science teacher and an engineer, and I do tutoring.
I'm Mary Swatsky, and I represent 17B, which is KDY County, and I reside in Wilmer. And I am presently a special education teacher at the Wilmer Middle School, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students, where we have a high population of Somali students and Hispanic, Latino. And I drove through the ball of twine today to get here in the rain, and that GPS is very interesting to get here. And not poison ivy, but I received tears over the 4th of July weekend, so.
Why don't we pass that mic back this way?
Hello, Representative Jason Isaacson. I represent Shoreview, Roseville, Little Canada, and I once again have trusted the Google Maps incorrectly, so I apologize. You got me to the other side of this park right here. So, very glad to be here. I am ailment-free and excited to have this meeting. So,
thank you, all members. And as I said earlier, in your package, you'll find the blue reimbursement form. Make sure you fill that out and get that into our staff so that we can make sure that we're covering the expenses, both your expenses and the committee expenses for this meeting. Representative Erickson, I wonder if you would be so kind as to move our minutes. So, I guess we have two sets of minutes, March 14th and March 21st.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes of March 14th and note that there are some technical corrections. Interestingly, to my name. I'm so glad I read through them.
And Representative Erickson moves adoption of the March 14th and 21st.
No, correct? I just did the 21st.
All right, the 14th, and can you tell us where the corrections are?
Oh, they're just on spellings of my name. That's kind of interesting. So sometimes I'm S-A-O, and then I'm Sandra at other times. And I think my dear friend here knows how to spell my name.
This is a common Minnesota thing, you know, O's, A's, and E's. I think that's something to do with our Nordic background. We'll make those corrections, and so members, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes of March 21st.
So Erickson moves the minutes of March 21st, and I trust that your name is correctly spelled.
Yes.
Wonderful. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erickson. All right, we're a little bit behind, but I think we're going to catch up fairly well. And so our first presentation is to hear from House Research, Lisa Larson. And Ms. Larson, I also think you have some documents to reference members to as you go through your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My colleague Tim Strom, I suspect, will have lots to add to this.
You'll need to hold it.
The point of this presentation is to talk very briefly about the process, the constitutional process to change the owner or the use of state bond finance property, since the Crosswind Schools is a state bond finance property. The state can and has used state debt capacity to fund programs that are of regional and statewide significance. The following is meant to provide some context for the state's interest in the Crosswind School and in Metropolitan Magnet School boards generally. During the 1990s, and at other times too, school desegregation and integration proponents have asserted the following. The Minnesota Constitution requires the state to provide an adequate education to all children. Children have a fundamental right to an adequate education. The state violates its duty and children's fundamental right to receive an adequate education where segregation based on race and socioeconomic status is permitted. And a segregated education is not an equal education and therefore not an adequate education. Prior bond appropriations for Metropolitan Magnet School grants to a group of qualified metropolitan school districts have appeared, for example, in Laws 1998, $3.8 million, Laws 1999, $1.3 million, Laws 2000, $16 million, Laws 2001, $1.7 million, and Laws 2005, $1.083 million. Representative Winkler's bill, House File 592, and I believe you have a summary that Tim prepared as well as the bill in your packet, proposing to transfer the Crosswind School to the Perfect Center for Arts Education was sent to the Capital Investment Committee precisely because the Crosswind School is a state bond finance property. Deb Dyson, committee counsel, presented the following information on transferring the ownership or changing the use of state bond finance property to the 2013 House Capital Investment Committee. The Crosswind School is a state bond finance property. The diagram that's on the screen, I hope somewhere.
Up against the lockers.
Yep. The diagram on the screen illustrates the process I'm about to outline in a rather cursory fashion. Unlike state authority to lease property, to transfer ownership or to change the use of a state bond finance property, the property either, one, must be determined to no longer be state bond finance property, or two, the legislature must authorize a change in ownership or in use in the same way that the legislature appropriates bond proceeds. And I think you can see it illustrated at the top of the diagram there. By a 3/5 vote of each body and with a bill originating in the House. To determine that a property is no longer a state bond finance property, one of two things must happen. Either the state agency to which the bonds were appropriated, MDE in this case, must determine that the property is no longer needed for the purpose for which the bonds were appropriated and then sell the property at fair market value. Or if the property, including any improvements made with state general obligation bonds, is older than 125% of the estimated useful life of the improved property, the property owner can work with the affected state agency, Minnesota Management and Budget, and the Minnesota Attorney General to remove the designation of state bond finance property. As an example, when the libraries in Hennepin County and Minneapolis were merged, the original appropriation to Minneapolis for the planetarium had to be amended to instead make the county the grantee. Minneapolis could not simply give the planetarium to Hennepin County as part of the merger. Whether bond proceeds used for acquiring and improving property have been repaid is not relevant to determining that a property is no longer a state bond finance property. A property is no longer a state bond finance property only if the affected state agency determines that the property is no longer needed for its intended purpose and then sells it at fair market value, or the improved property is older than 125% of its estimated useful life, and the affected state agency, MMB, and the AG work to remove the designation. And I hope that this explanation is made clear by the diagram. It's a kind of flow chart, and you can see there are really two options here. These limitations ensure that the intent of the Constitution is followed. The Constitution requires specificity with respect to the name of the entity and the purpose or statutory program for which the bond proceeds are authorized. The recipient of the bond proceeds appropriation is not simply a fiscal agent. It cannot, under the Constitution, transfer the appropriation to an ineligible entity, use it for an ineligible purpose as a way around the constitutional limits on use of state debt, or transfer it to an entity or use it for a purpose the legislature did not authorize. The question in these cases is always whether the substance of the desired transaction was contemplated in what the legislature enacted. If there is any doubt, and the standard of bond counsel is very high, then the provision has to be amended, either directly or by specific reference, and passed in the same way as bond proceeds appropriations, a 3/5 vote in each House and a bill originating in the House. It can be argued that this constitutional process shows the significance the legislature attached to magnet school grants and to the Crosswind School.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. And let me say, we don't have this particular schematic in your packets, but we will make this available, and we'll also make it available for the public by making sure that it's part of what will get posted on our website. So for those of you in the audience, a good practice is to go on the Minnesota House Representative website. If you go onto the different committees, there's a committee page, and on those pages you can find the minutes of meetings as well as most documents that are shared at those meetings. And so we'll be sure to post this schematic there for you. The intent here wasn't to spend a whole lot of time on this particular issue. However, we are also joined by our other House research staff person, Tim Strom, who has served with us for quite a while, enough so that he has some history with the decisions relative to this particular property as well as ongoing integration revenue designs. And so at this point, I'll pause very quickly to see if there are any comments from committee members, and then I'm going to move on to our next testifier. Before I do that, I do want to acknowledge Representative Ryan Winkler has joined us. And Representative Winkler, your community you represent is all encompassed within St. Louis
Park, is that correct?
St. Louis Park, Golden Valley, part of Plymouth.
All right, St. Louis Park, Golden Valley.
A little bit of Plymouth.
And part of Plymouth. So welcome. Thank you for being with us here today. Members, any questions or rather any thoughts? We don't really want to
spent a whole lot of time with questions on this particular issue, but if there's anything of interest that you want to share, that anything that got triggered here for you, please. All right, very well. And if that gets triggered later, then we'll pick up your thoughts and questions at that point. So now I'm going to ask former Representative Myron Orfield, who is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota and a director of the Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity, to come forward and share his testimony with us in terms of the issue of compelling state interest relative to the Integration Revenue Program, of course, of which within that compelling state interest, this particular building was established as a regional magnet school. And so, Mr. Orfield, if you can come forward, it'd be wonderful. And I think there's a panel that might should be there for you.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me
pretty well?
Hold it closer.
How about now? Can everybody hear me now? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today. I'm a law professor, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the law as it relates to integration, and then a little bit about some of the demographics of the region and some of the situations in the metropolitan area, the growing racial segregation in the city schools, and in most of the schools of the fully developed suburbs. I think for a long time people have thought of racial segregation as just simply an urban issue. The most rapid increase in racial segregation is now in the suburbs of the Twin Cities. And they are changing at almost twice the rate the central cities became segregated. So I'll talk a little bit about that and with a little bit of some maps and some charts. It's interesting that Representative Erdahl was just at Gettysburg. Minnesota's interest in integration really goes back to the Civil War. Minnesota was a very fiercely abolitionist state. And after the 14th Amendment was passed, we were the second state in the Union to forbid racial segregation in schools. We did it by statute in 1869. The Iowa Supreme Court declared segregation unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. We did it by the legislature, Republican legislature, forbid racial segregation in our schools, and also withheld funds to schools that practiced segregation. We were the first state in the country to do that. And never really, it became a very big issue when the Congress passed Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And if you look at the legislative testimony surrounding that, people harken back to Minnesota pioneering that practice. In 1896, the Supreme Court allowed segregated schools, saying separate but equal was all right in Plessy versus Ferguson. In 1954, the Supreme Court overruled that decision in May of 1954, saying that racially segregated schools, intentionally racially segregated schools, were inherently unequal, that they dramatically decreased the educational access of non-white students, that they affected their ability to participate in the political process in the armed forces, and that they were inherently unequal. The Supreme Court said in Brown versus Board of Education, racially segregated schools are inherently unequal, and they are likely to affect the hearts and minds of children in ways that will never be undone. After this, these cases were fairly clear in the South, where you had racially segregated statutes, Jim Crow segregation. Trying to find out what constituted de jure segregation in the North, it took a little while. It really wasn't until the early 70s, in a case called Keyes versus Denver School District, the Supreme Court outlined what de jure segregation meant. And the Supreme Court in Keyes, and later in the Dayton case, Dayton versus Brinkman and Columbus versus Pennock, the Supreme Court outlined a certain number of behaviors that constituted intentional racial segregation. The gerrymandering of school district boundaries, so the drawing of school boundaries in ways that created racial segregation, could give rise to a presumption of racial segregation. Transfer policies that allowed white children to avoid racially integrated schools disproportionately and go to whiter schools. This was evidence of intentional racial segregation. Segregated faculties, all the non-white teachers teaching in certain schools and the schools where white children were being dominated by all white teachers. This could amount to intentional racial segregation. In Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg, the Supreme Court said the disproportionate building of affordable housing discrimination could constitute de jure school segregation, so that if a governmental entity was building disproportionately affordable housing, government-subsidized affordable housing in ways that promoted segregation, if it was constructing new schools in edge districts, in white districts at the edge of metropolitan areas, this too could give rise to an inference of intentional racial segregation. So, interestingly enough, in Minnesota, there was a case called Booker versus Minneapolis School District. In that case, Minneapolis was found guilty of intentional racial segregation. And that case is a close one at home to me. It involved my high school, Washburn High School, right before I was going to attend Washburn High School. Washburn High School had drawn a boundary and had added an addition. And Washburn High School, right before I went to high school, was about 98% white and was considered the best high school in the city. And the federal court found that the drawing of that boundary around my high school constituted intentional racial segregation. And the court ordered Minneapolis to be desegregated by law. So because of the federal district court in Booker versus Minneapolis School District Number 1, I had the great privilege of going to racially integrated schools. I probably wouldn't have otherwise, and it really was a wonderful experience for me, changed my life in lots of ways. But those are the kinds of conduct, that's the kind of conduct that can give rise to this. Now, in the absence of de jure segregation, the question is, what can school districts do to integrate schools? In Swan, the court said almost anything, that this is a good thing, that we believe in integration, almost anything. In the case of Parents Involved versus Seattle School District Number 1, decided in 2007, the court was more circumspect on what local school districts could do to integrate schools. The court held that there is a compelling governmental interest in racial integration. Justice Kennedy, speaking for himself and four other members of the court, said that there is a compelling interest in integration. It's a very important interest, citing back to Brown in those cases. He recently said this again in Fisher versus Texas. This last week, Justice Kennedy again said racial integration is a compelling governmental interest. Justice Kennedy also said the avoidance of racial isolation is a compelling governmental interest. So these are things that school districts have a lot of leeway. School districts and states have a lot of leeway if they want to integrate kids. Now, Parents Involved said that the local school districts or states couldn't create programs where one child was denied admission and one child was accepted in admission solely on the basis of race. That was outlawed. Prior to Parents Involved, a lot of school districts read the Swan case and believed that that was permissible. That's no longer permissible. Parents Involved, however, said that states and local governments can draw boundaries to be racially integrated. They can design transfer programs that don't discriminate on an individual basis, that don't deny student admission solely on the basis of race or cause admission solely on the basis of race. Although race can be used as one of many factors in admission to a selective magnet program, it can't be used as the sole basis. States and local school districts can use incentives to try to encourage integration. They can use programs and special funds to do those things. So almost all the old tools that places have used to integrate are still available, except decisions where an individual student is accepted or denied solely on the basis of race. So these are the broad factors of legal analysis. I'm just going to show a few slides showing the rapid increase in racial segregation in the metropolitan area. The Twin Cities was the home to many very important civil rights leaders, both non-white and non-white. Roy Wilkins was from the Twin Cities. The auditorium is named after him. Hubert Humphrey was an author of the principal sponsor of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Vice President. Elmer L. Anderson was a very, very powerful civil rights Republican leader. Harold Stassen as well. Minnesota passed the first human rights law under Republican leadership in the 1950s. So it was a bipartisan, every one of the Republican and Democratic members voted for all the civil rights bills in the 1960s. So it was a bipartisan thing. And Minnesota had a very strong commitment to both integrated schools and integrated housing up through the early 90s. The Minnesota didn't have a single racially segregated school until the early 1990s, and people often looked at us and thought this was very strange, that Minnesota must be more like Sweden or Canada than the rest of the United States. We were the last major metropolitan area that didn't have a single racially segregated school. In 1993, we only had six. Last year, we had 135 racially segregated schools that are more than 80% non-white and poor. And we are gaining racially segregated elementary schools faster than any place in the country. We haven't reached the national average yet. We're about two-thirds of the way to the national average. If we were average in the nation, we would have about another 70 or 80. We're quickly going to achieve that, though. We're quickly coming up to the average. We used to have sort of a utopian system if you thought racial integration was a good thing. We're now rapidly catching up to the rest of the country. Here's a map that shows the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and each of these elementary schools, each of these dots is an elementary school. This is 2009. It's a little bit outdated. Every red school has more than 80% non-white students. The orange schools are 50 to 80. Light orange are 33 to 49. Light blue are 20 to 33, and the dark blue are the whitest. Now, this is a little bit hard to see. I'm going to get some better maps in a second. But you can see that the central city is dominated. Both central cities are dominated by schools that are in those top two categories. And most of the segregated schools as of 2009 were in the central cities, although about 35% of them were in the first ring suburbs. This is in 2009. This is poverty. And poverty and race often are tied together. White poor children, by and large, in this metropolitan area and throughout the country go to middle-income schools. Non-white poor children, particularly black and Latino poor children, go to overwhelmingly poor schools. And this is because of persistent residential discrimination in the housing market. Because of steering practices like steering, the way that real estate agents and rental agents treat non-white households and home buyers. Mortgage lending discrimination forms a big part of this. We have the largest disparity in mortgage lending discrimination in the United States. A black family that earns $157,000 in this metropolitan area is less likely to qualify for a prime loan than a white family that earns $40,000. A disproportionate placement of affordable housing within the boundaries of segregated or integrated school attendance areas, exclusionary zoning, a variety of other issues, consistent discrimination against non-white citizens. So you can see that poverty and race tie together. When children go to high poverty schools, that the evidence about educational effects is really powerfully clear. High poverty schools powerfully depress graduation rates. The Supreme Court recently, in the Parents Involved case, heard testimony from over 2,000, and received briefs from over 2,000 scholars on the subject of integration. And there were three briefs that talked about the benefits of integration, two briefs that disputed those benefits, but no one disputed the fact that going to economically integrated schools is very important in terms of graduation rate, in terms of college attendance, in terms of later earnings, having a decent job, a middle-class job. These were all powerfully related to going to middle-income schools, racially integrated schools. Test scores, the experts did dispute how much test scores were affected by integration. This is a map that shows the change in the percentage of minority students, and the red schools are changing more than 25 points, and you can see that most of the big change is going on in the first-ring suburbs. Most of the places that are becoming racially diverse are in the first-ring suburbs. That's also true about becoming socially diverse. More than half of non-white families now live in the suburbs. If you look at non-white families that earn above the median income, 60% live in the suburbs. If you look at non-white married families with children, 75% live in the suburbs. Now, as non-white married families with children move to the suburbs, they are treated very differently in the housing market than white families of similar education, income, and credit history. Non-white families are often shown parts of the suburbs where the schools are racially diverse. White families of similar education, income, and credit history are often shown much whiter suburban areas where the schools are much whiter. This is called steering, and it's a very common practice. The superintendents of many of the suburban school districts have talked about this. The superintendents of Robbinsdale, of Richfield, of St. Louis Park, of Roseville, South St. Paul and West St. Paul have always talked consistently about this kind of a practice. Anyway, this often leads to growing segregation. These are test scores, and you can see that the high poverty schools have the lowest test scores on the MCA2s. Poverty is the strongest correlant to test scores. This is another thing that young middle class families look at when they're buying houses. They look at the test scores of the local school districts. The test scores are often, they're clear representations of poverty. Poverty is the highest correlant to test scores. But when families are buying houses, they see the low test scores, they decide not to buy there, and it has an effect on continuing the process of disinvestment. And this is a lot of times happening in the first ring suburbs. So the first one was math, the second one was reading. You can see they're very similar. Graduation rates in the high poverty schools and the high schools of the cities in the older suburbs, graduation rates are much depressed on all measures and by whoever is keeping track of this. This is the grad test. These are dropout rates. You can see the high schools, red and orange, have the highest dropout rates. These are four-year attendance rates. They're just different ways to calculate dropouts. I'm talking about Minneapolis. Minneapolis has really changed fast. Minneapolis has become has gone from about 52,000 students at its recent peak in the early 90s, last year 31,000 students, really dramatic loss of students. I'm going to show you a time series of the Minneapolis schools, and you can see in 1995 they were relatively integrated. You'll see over time the schools southwest of Lake Harriet will become almost all white. The schools in the near south of Minneapolis will become almost all Latino. The schools in the north side will become almost all black. And you'll see a dramatic loss of population from the near south side and the near north side. You'll see the white areas of the city very full with schools expanded. So this is 95 to 96, 7. You can see the pattern. And you'll see, again, the blue is white, yellow is Latino, red is black, orange is Asian, Pacific Islander. You'll start to see fast changes now. You can see the schools south of Lake Harriet, the blue little Pac-Men are closing, and it shows they're becoming whiter. And you'll see the schools disappearing fast. By 2010 and 2011, the white schools in the southwest quadrant of Minneapolis, Lake Harriet School, was rated among the three or four highest scoring schools in the state. It had the state chess championship team. It had a pathway toward Southwest High School, which was a pathway to the best colleges in the country. A few miles away, you had schools where the strongest career pathway was prison, and that particularly among young men in the most segregated schools. In the same school district, a few miles away, some kids were on the way to Yale, and on the other side of the city, some kids were on the way to jail. And it was the same school system, the same curriculum, the same basic things. The difference was racial segregation and those challenges. You'll see free lunch. As the white kids disappear from the racially integrated schools, you'll see the middle class kids disappear. As the kids of color disappear from the white schools south of Lake Harriet, scoring among the highest in the state, you'll see the poor kids disappear. So Minneapolis is coming back to what it was before the case. Well, here's the test scores, and these are the MCA tests. You'll see Lake Harriet and Borough School among the highest scoring elementary schools in the state, and you'll see a few miles away some of the lowest scoring schools. Residential segregation has greatly intensified in the Twin Cities. We used to be a place, again, like our schools. We didn't really have segregated schools. We really didn't have segregated neighborhoods. These are the patterns of segregation in 1980. You see 1990, 2000, and 2000. This is a map that shows predominantly non-white neighborhoods in 1990. Those are red. The areas that are green are racially integrated between 20 and 60%. So this is 1990. This is 2000. So you see the areas of predominantly non-white status growing, racial isolation. You see integrated areas growing, involving many of the suburbs. This is 2005 to 2009. You see big parts of the suburbs are becoming integrated. And this is 2010, where you see a pattern of lots of the suburbs becoming racially integrated. I'm going to skip up ahead with St. Paul and get to some of the suburbs so I don't take too much time. You get a former legislator who's a law professor. It's hard to keep him quiet. This is Osseo in the northern suburbs. This is a path that black families are moving through, particularly black middle-income families. And I'm going to show you the same time series about the schools that are changing there. This is 95, and you'll see really the rapid racial change in the Osseo school district. So Osseo is divided from east to west. It's west side is becoming more integrated. East side is majority non-white. All the same things have happened in that school area with low test scores and low attainment. They're doing better than the schools in North Minneapolis, but not having the same access that they used to. Poverty, again, follows suit. Test scores, again. I'm going to look at the south. This is Richfield and Bloomington. You can see this movement. Richfield is a majority non-white school system. It's almost 80% non-white last year and poor. Bloomington has mostly non-white on the east side. The west side is more integrated. Poverty follows suit. And test scores. This is the northwest suburbs. Here's Roseville and North St. Paul, Maplewood, White Bear. You can see the trends changing there. Oops. This is the most recent year. And poverty. I just have one more set of slides and then I'll slow down. This is South St. Paul, West St. Paul. And you can see the changes there. Now, I think one of the things that people think that is that segregation in schools is about choices. And there's very little evidence to say that racially segregated schools are the choices of non-white families. All of the data suggesting preferences suggest a very strong preference for integrated schools among non-white families and students. There's a lot of housing discrimination that is involved. There's certainly steering at very high levels, mortgage lending discrimination. We place most of our affordable housing in ways that intensifies racial segregation. These are very clear goals. We also know that kids, particularly non-white kids, are doing the best in the Twin Cities in racially integrated schools, particularly black children in the racially integrated schools in the western suburbs are scoring the highest scores on their test scores, are achieving access to college at the highest rates. We are beginning to see in the poorest schools very strong pathways to incarceration. The Institute of Race and Poverty is now the Institute of Metropolitan Area, Institute of Metropolitan Opportunity has been taking a look at the children in prison and finding, trying to understand the relationship of high schools to prison, and they're very powerful. And peer groups are very powerful in this. So, to bring us full circle, the Supreme Court in Brown said that racially segregated schools were inherently unequal. And they said that was the case because they offered unequal educational and economic opportunities. That's certainly true in the Twin Cities. Racially segregated schools are unequal, and they offer inherently unequal access to education, higher education, and opportunities. They're growing very fast. Given the standards of discrimination, given the ideas that school boundaries and that racially segregative transfer programs may constitute intentional racial segregation still, we have a lot of questions that we should be asking. If we have an open enrollment system that predominantly allows white children to leave racially integrated settings to go to whiter settings, is this something that the Supreme Court has declared questionable in Keyes, Dayton, and Columbus? We have now a great growth of racially segregated charter schools. These charter schools are exempted from Minnesota Rule 3535. It's one of the only places in the country where charter schools are specifically exempted from civil rights rules. Increasing percentage of them are single race. The Supreme Court in Swan said that when there are a disproportionate number of single race schools that are publicly sponsored, this creates a presumption of intentional racial segregation. We've had boundary controversies in a number of our school districts. Eden Prairie recently drew integrated boundaries, but many school districts have drawn segregated boundaries. Bloomington drew boundaries that had segregated impact just last year. The East Carver County School District has drawn school boundaries that have had segregated impact. The Washington County School District has drawn boundaries that have segregated impact. Minneapolis School District has drawn boundaries that have segregated impact. These are questions, I think, that bear examination. Nevertheless, I think the evidence is clear that racially integrated schools are good for kids of color. They're good for white kids. They're good for all kids. They help sponsor a sense of diversity and help us understand our future. One of the things that Justice Kennedy noted in the Fisher case and that Justice O'Connor did in the Grutter and Gratz case is that diversity is also a compelling governmental interest, and that going to diverse schools not only enriches the experience of non-white kids, but prepares white children for the racially diverse country and the racially diverse world that we are approaching. Last year, in May, on the anniversary of Brown, the New York Times announced that the majority of the children born that day and henceforth were non-white in the United States. And so we crossed that threshold. We are a multiracial society, whether we like it or not. And we have the option of whether we are going to move into our future together in a multiracial way, or whether we're going to move into our future separately with racially separate schools and economically separate schools. I think these are the challenges. So I apologize for talking too long, and I'd be happy to answer questions, go over the cases.
Thank you. thank you. I won't say Meyer, but Mr. I was struck by the Brown quote and the Supreme Court decision about the effect on the hearts and minds of children that are difficult to undo. And I'm particularly struck by how perhaps even more relevant that is in a society that's even more multiracially diverse than in the 1950s. I think we do have a couple of questions. Let me just ask one very quickly. Why isn't this just about poverty then? I mean, I know you made a long, you know, argument here, but as you go through the progression of impacts of schools, obviously there's a huge poverty correlate here. Why isn't it just about poverty?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that it's not just about poverty is that by and large, poor white children, although this is beginning to change, by and large, poor white children have access to middle-income schools. So if you look at where poor white children live in this region or in the United States, about three-quarters of poor white children attend schools in schools that are more than 70% middle-class kids. Three-quarters of poor black and Latino kids attend schools that are more than 70% poor. That's true in this metropolitan area. That's true across the country. And one of the things, if you're white, you're able to find the nooks and crannies of affordable housing in good school districts, and you're allowed to live there. Rental agents allow you to live there. You're not steered away from them by real estate agents. You have social networks that help you locate that kind of housing, connections and relatives. So you live in that kind of housing. And poor non-white kids don't have access to that kind of housing. And increasingly, that housing is getting harder to find. And if you go to overwhelmingly poor schools, whether they're all white or all minority, they still have very bad effects on kids. So there are some overwhelmingly poor all-white schools in Appalachia and in a few parts of the state. These schools are associated with really strong increases in dropping out. These schools are associated with little connection to college or higher education. There's not very many all-white poor schools in the country. There are a few. And where they exist, they have the same detrimental effects on kids. So in some ways, we're talking about poverty, but because of race and because of racial discrimination, poor white children have more access to middle-income schools. That being said, economic segregation is now on the rise, and the last census shows that we're starting to see discrimination on the basis of economics in this country. We never have before. And so while poor white children have access to these schools now, they may not in the future.
I'm going to ask Representative Verbal to pose this question, and then I'll call on Representative Isaacson and Representative Bly. So you have to quickly pass this mic.
Okay. Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Warfield. Once a representative, always a representative. You mentioned the open enrollment and, you know, white students transferring using that. I'm just wondering, is there much, how does open enrollment affect students of color? Do they use it as well?
They went to
white schools?
Yes, we did a report on this, and it's on our website at the Institute of Metropolitan Opportunity. We did a real in-depth analysis of it, and children of all races use open enrollment. It tends to favor kids whose parents have cars that can get them to the district. We have a system of open enrollment that kind of tries to balance that, called the Choice is Yours. And the Choice is Yours allows about 2,500 kids a year to use open enrollment, but the state provides transportation to equalize them. And so that program works reasonably well in terms of kids, low-income kids, having a choice to go to higher-income schools. But if they're dependent on their families, it's harder. And there's a pattern over time. If we looked at the pattern, we saw that increasingly, year after year, we saw kids leaving, for example, the St. Louis Park School District going to Minnetonka, leaving the Hopkins School District to go to Minnetonka, leaving the Eden Prairie School District to go to Minnetonka. Eden Prairie, East Carver County, St. Louis Park, Robbinsdale were racially diverse. And you see a large flow of white children using open enrollment to go to Minnetonka, which is a very white school district. You don't see kids of color using that for whatever reason. That's a good question to understand why that might be. But you see kids, white kids, using that open enrollment system to avoid going to integrated schools a lot and to go to whiter schools, another ring further out in the suburbs.
Members, I do want to move rather quickly. We are behind, but we started behind. I do want to get the Crosswinds testimony in before we do our little break, and then we'll hear from the Romney School after that. Representative Isaacs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Orfield. Just a quick question. You had said that up until about 93, we were fairly integrated, then 93 on, and for those of us that are aware of the history there, can you explain to me what exactly was occurring around 1993 to see us go from such a good record of integration to what seems to be an increasingly poor record of integration?
Well, a lot of things, with big dramatic changes, it's not one thing that happened. I think one issue was the region became a lot more racially diverse. In 1993, we were the second whitest region in the country, now we're the third, and we've had a big increase in diversity. And as places become more diverse, they often become more segregated. So that's a part of it. We also had a very strong integration rule that said that if schools were segregated within a district, or if there was segregative activity, the state would withhold funds. And so this rule, when it was applied, the school districts paid very close attention to this, and they stayed integrated. We also had a very strong metropolitan housing rule. So for about 20 years, we were building most of our affordable housing in the whitest part of suburbia in the Twin Cities. So from 1970 till about the early 90s, we built three-quarters of all our subsidized housing in the whitest part of the suburbs. And those three things made a huge difference, being very white, having a very strong civil rights rule, and having a very strong housing rule. We abandoned the housing rule in the 80s completely. We changed the school desegregation rule in the late 90s, to take all the penalties and consequences out of it. Our school desegregation rule actually says right now in its SONAR, the Statement of Needs and the background administrative documents, says that there is no compelling interest in racial integration. So it actually misstates the law presently. The present document does. I think they were trying to read the tea leaves and where the Supreme Court was going. They were looking at some cases in the Fifth Circuit and the Second Circuit. But the Supreme Court in 2007, Justice Kennedy said very clearly, four or five times, and again, several times recently, that there is a compelling governmental interest in avoiding racial isolation. So it was the abandonment of our civil rights rules for education, the abandonment of our civil rights rules for housing, and at the same time becoming a lot more diverse.
I'll try to be quick, although I have sort of complicated questions here. One thing, I have heard your presentation before and found it very challenging and compelling, and appreciate the work that you're doing. One thing you mentioned in a previous presentation was the impact of peers on behavior, especially in the high school age kids, and that also has a lot of impact on what happens with these issues. A lot of my history is in alternative schools and charter schools as well. And I've been challenged by this notion of choice. Now, all charter schools and charter schools are supposed to be choice schools. And one of the things, as I've gone around the state and talked to different folks, especially from communities of color, they don't like alternative schools, and some of them like charter schools for various reasons, but a lot of the reason is because they feel they have no choice, that they're placed at these places, and there is kind of de facto segregation going on where they end up in these schools. And I guess I'm wondering, I think culture plays a huge role in all of this as well, which gets back to why it isn't just poverty that we're looking at. But, you know, I know of kids that don't necessarily fit in a certain school, and they get sort of pushed off, perhaps by behavior, perhaps because not really being understood by the administrators or teachers or whatever, or not. I guess my question has to do with if you could speak to that issue of culture, but also it occurs to me that integration is something that takes a lot of work and commitment and intent, and it's not something that just happens. You have to really work at it. So,
well, I think what's the notion of choice, and I think one of the questions is, do non-white children prefer single-race schools? Is this something that they prefer? Well, there's no evidence in any of the research that's the case. If you look at the surveys of kids, there are a small percentage do, very small, less than 10% do, but the vast majority believe that racially integrated schools are their highest goal. Now, not many, a lot of non-white poor kids don't have a choice to go to a racially integrated school. And a lot of times they're going to a really terrible segregated public school. A person like me doesn't have any qualms about saying that the public schools that are deeply racially and socially segregated are not doing a good job for kids. It's hard. I agree with the Supreme Court that segregation is inherently unequal. So kids, I think, that are going to quite segregated public schools sometimes opt into quite segregated charter schools. But they often, within 18 or 24 months, opt back. There's a very short lifespan in these all non-white charter schools. Kids are moving in and out of them at the speed of light, and they aren't doing very well in these schools. They're, you know, the most optimistic projections are that non-white charter schools are about the same as the non-white public schools. I think the majority of the research suggests they underperform the public schools at similar levels of income. This question was outlined by the Supreme Court in the Keys, Dayton, and Columbus cases. And in all those cases, the school districts at issue had created single-race schools that they were trying to respond, they said, to community goals. They created single-race black high schools, single-race black elementary schools in all those three cities. And they had some popularity in all those three cities. The Supreme Court decided this was an unfair practice, that to create single-race schools to try to incent children away from integrated schools was an evidence of intentional racial segregation. Now, maybe the Supreme Court would think differently now, but the state of the law suggests that the creation of single-race schools is evidence of bad intent.
Professor Erickson has a question, and then we're going to, after that, we're going to move on to hear testimony from Principal Bass. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome from Representative Orfield. I find your research to be very interesting, and yet I question this. To what extent, though, is it always engaged parents, or I should say involved parents, engaged students, and affected teachers that really make the difference? Because I look at Hiawatha Academy, and I look at Crystal Ray, and I look at other public schools in both Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the suburbs who have high achievement based on those three elements. So to what extent are we missing the mark by not focusing more on that?
Well, I think you're quite right. The most powerful predictor of a child's success educationally and economically is who their parents are. So if you look at the parents' income and their educational background and the stability of their marriage, these three things are the most powerfully predictive of a kid's success. If they have educated in parents that have a good income, that have a stable marriage, the odds are really in their favor. So what I say to poor kids all the time is you should go out and get some good parents, because that's the most important thing you can do. After that, the most powerful connections to educational success and opportunity is the peer group of kids. It's documented to be a more powerful relationship than different types of teaching conduct. So I think the idea is that if you can't, you don't have these patterns of behavior and success within your own family, which is by far and away much more important than peers. If they don't exist in your own family, the second best place to find these is in a peer group of kids around you. Kids that can help model that behavior, that can show you the way. One of the reasons that poor kids graduate from middle-class high schools is because all their peers do. One of the reasons that poor kids go to college from middle-class high schools is because all their peers do. One of the reasons that kids go to prison from very poor high schools is because all their peers do. Now, I think that Hiawatha Academy and Harvest Prep are showing some really good statistics. There are not many schools like that. There's two or three. There's 122 charter schools. There's two or three that show those kinds of statistics. And I think I would like to see a closer examination of how are kids accepted into these schools. Is there any kind of screening? Is there any kind of, are all kids admitted? Are they the same kids? Because if you're picking highly motivated kids from highly motivated families, you're going to have different results. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case. I don't know the answer, but I think it bears some pretty close examination. Now, there's 122 charter schools. There's three or four really high-scoring ones. There are multiple times more low-scoring. If you look at the LoveWorks Academy regularly, almost no one passes the test year after year. So for every Harvest Prep, there's four or five LoveWorks Academies, and I think that's one of the things that we have to keep in mind.
All right, thank you, Representative Orfield. A conversation to be continued, I hope, and thank you for your testimony and your time here, and for the work that you do in Minnesota as well. I would ask Mr. Principal Bass to come forward. And I know we're pushing, we were supposed to start this part about 20 minutes ago. We started 15 minutes late, so we're actually running pretty well. If we can't get through all of the Crosswinds testimony by 12:30, we'll certainly come back to that, because I do want to hear for the two schools in particular and people from both those schools here today. So we will break at 12:30, so Mr. Bass, I think, gives us about 20 minutes, and perhaps your testimony might be shorter than that. If that's the case, then we'll ask Ms. Bain Kuzmarski to come forward. If not, we will get her testimony after lunch. So welcome to the committee, and it looks like you're setting up a PowerPoint. And again, we will work to get these documents up on our website. And so if you do have a PowerPoint in your presentation, if you can share it with staff and Jamal here, then we can readily do that. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brian Bass, Crosswinds Principal. I'm just completing my third year as principal here at Crosswinds. I also want to say a warm welcome to all of you to Crosswinds, and also a warm welcome to all of our guests who are here in the audience as well. So I want to acknowledge them, as well as our board members and the superintendents that are with us from the East Metro this morning. I want to welcome them as well. So thank you. So I've been asked to try to provide a program overview for Crosswinds in the context of this integration conversation that we're having today. So I'm excited to do that. I'm actually honored to do that. In starting off, I was given a letter this morning that was actually addressed to Representative Mariani by one of our middle school math teachers here at Crosswinds, and I think it speaks to what the legacy of Crosswinds has meant to both our students and our staff as it relates to integration. I'd like to start with that and then go through some of the program features here at Crosswinds and then talk a little bit about the results of our efforts. And then if there are any specific questions that you have for me before we turn it over to our parent and student presenters this morning. So, dear Representative Mariani, I am writing to advocate for the proposition that Purpich takes over governance of Crosswinds. The death of Crosswinds over the past 2 years has felt, as a teacher here, like an elongated eulogy, but with no death. Our students have been earnest in trying to keep the school alive through the arts and the cross-cultural vibrance that Crosswinds generates. Without intentional integration, akin to a school-based immersion program, cross-cultural skills remain stagnant and students regress surrounding themselves with people that look like them, talk like them, and maybe think like them. Ask a Crosswind student which friends he keeps, and he'll name three or more different cultures. Without intentional integration, we as a people are unchallenged, homogeneous, and frankly boring. And the arts serve as a channel for cross-cultural communication, for students to get beyond curbside superficiality and dig deep to get to a commonality. Only the arts ignites this channel. Preserve Crosswinds through Perpich, the progressive legacy of a school can't die here. Something rare began here. Simply listen to the whispers of those in the know that tell you integration is what makes this country unlike any other. Just listen. Respectfully, Carl Lepper, sixth grade math teacher here at Crosswinds. The mission and vision of Crosswinds is to provide voluntary integration opportunities for middle school students from urban and suburban communities to enhance achievement and experience diversity in a year-round education program. Additionally, we seek a diverse educational environment where each student's special talents, gifts, and needs are recognized as a way to develop a community of responsible citizens. Some of the highlights of our program is the first middle school in Minnesota to bring together urban and suburban students with this intentional effort, the anchor being St. Paul, and then reaching as far as, I think even beyond our suburban, into even some rural context on the other side of the South Washington County School District. Second point here is built upon success of early voluntary joint integration programs in year-round elementary schools, our arts and science magnet. Our arts and science magnet focus provides exciting and rigorous educational opportunities. In the first year of the inception of the program, this is what the data looked like on the school in terms of our demographics. 72% urban students, 28% suburban, 52% students of color, and 50% students on free and reduced lunch. So this is shortly after the slide, I think, that celebrated some of our strongest integration efforts across the state. Just a few years past that, 1993, I think, is what Representative Warfield had mentioned earlier. This is Crosswinds today. And this compares us to the state averages, 50% students of color, 23% who receive special education services, so we're slightly overrepresented with students who receive special education services. Students who qualify for free or reduced meals, again, we're 49% there, and then students who receive English language learner services, 12%, just slightly larger than the state average there as well. So our program features, what I think in some of the questions that you all asked earlier, I think what is special and significant about bringing students together in an integrated learning environment? And I think there's two kind of pieces here that are the legacy that I hope you all walk away with in terms of our presentation about here at EMID, is that we have to have a rigorous educational learning program for our students. They have to have access to highly effective teachers that understand how to meet them where they're at and to accelerate their learning towards benchmarks in a way that builds off of the assets that they bring to school from the different cultural backgrounds of our students. And so that's one key feature. And so the other point here is that many schools will, I think, we're hearing now say that they have become more integrated and they have become more diverse. And we argue that simply doesn't make you authentically integrated. It's the way that those students interact. It's the testimony in Mr. Lupker's letter earlier about the way in which the students are intentionally designed to interact with each other through the curriculum. And so I want to make sure that those points were made here in the presentation. So we do offer the IB, the International Baccalaureate Middle Years Program, an integrated arts program. We have a rich rich opportunities for outdoor learning. I'm not sure if when you drove up, you took a step back. I certainly did when I first drove up to Crosswinds, because this is an outstanding piece of property. We sit on 28 acres, and almost all of the ecosystems in Minnesota are represented on our campus, and our students are absolutely immersed and study those different ecosystems through our environmental science curriculum here at Crosswinds. Our facility, as you see, is designed for interdisciplinary, open, project-based learning, and then we do have an intentional emphasis on intercultural and international mindedness. We utilize professional artists and scientists for both curriculum design and instruction. We have recently implemented the Advancement via Individual Termination program, the AVID program, the College and Career Readiness System that many schools are implementing across the state. And then technology is integrated throughout the curriculum. Crosswinds has received in the arts some outstanding acknowledgments and accomplishments in the area of orchestra. I've included that here in this slide. We have, for 7 consecutive years, earned ratings of superior or above from all of the judges. And we are very proud of that. And this was the 4th time that we've received the ranking of superior with distinction. So we're very proud of the accomplishments of our students. We have integrated themes around intercultural awareness and international mindedness throughout the arts. This production of The Wiz was one example of that that was featured 2 years ago. In 2012, we had students that participated in the World Savvy Challenge. The student who's in the center there is actually going to be speaking to you shortly, as well as the student on the other side. Sam Larson's in the middle, and Nate Celeste there in the end will be speaking to you later. Sam actually earned a trip to Bangladesh to actually study climate change for several weeks. So we're very proud of that accomplishment as well. This is our students at work. Oops. Uh-oh. Our data, this is the slide that has the data on our student achievement as it relates to the Northwest Evaluation Association, or the MAP, the Measures of Academic Progress. And I apologize for this. And the presentation will be provided to you so that it will have the data. But in 2011-2012, 63% of the students, all students at Crosswinds, when we average all students together, met or exceeded the proficiency target for measures of academic progress in their respective grade level. In reading, 65% of the students met or exceeded the national average for proficiency in their respective grade levels. The remarkable thing is that many students choose Crosswinds after having been unsuccessful in some of the larger school experiences, oftentimes being multiple years behind in grade level proficiency. And we're proud to celebrate that nearly 95% of our 10th grade students that moved on last year from Crosswinds were proficient at grade level in reading and writing, which is remarkable, considering that they're coming multiple grade levels behind when they enter our system. So you've done the work of fostering relationships across cultures, and you've given them access to a curriculum that accelerates their learning from where they're at towards the benchmarks that are there on the state assessments. So very, very, very proud of that accomplishment. Here's some additional awards that Crosswinds has earned, and I'll just let you read those. I'm not sure the folks in the back can see them very well, so maybe I should read them. The Minnesota Alliance with Youth Lieutenant Governor's Red Wagon Award, the Crosswinds SOAR Scholars for Improving Student Academic Outcomes, Engaging Youth in Service, St. Paul Rotary Club Outstanding Accomplishments, Performing Arts Consultants, the Big Apple Classic Grand Champion, that was for our orchestra program, and the Performing Arts Consultant 4-day Chicago, Illinois, where our students earned gold rating both our band program and our orchestra program. These are the additional partnerships that we have. I definitely will not read that long list. And that's. I really wanted to be brief and provide a time for you to ask questions if there are some specific points that you wanted to address.
Yes, please. And I'll ask them very quickly, and then Representative Rudolph. So earlier you said that the mere fact that there's greater representation of different students by race and culture in a school does not necessarily mean that it's integrated. And then you offered up an interpretation from Crosswinds about what that is, and you said that it's about how the school is intentionally designed for students to interact through the curriculum. I'm wondering maybe you can expound on that a little bit. Obviously, for much of our nation's history, we've tended to do the head counting, aspect of integration. Why is it important to go beyond that? Why is it important to be intentional about designing interactions and doing that through curriculum, and I assume through pedagogical practices as well?
Right. Tony Wagner in Creating Innovators and the Global Achievement Gap is a leading educational researcher, talks about students, if they're going to be prepared for the 21st century, some of these skills are going to be contingent upon their ability to exercise global citizenship skills. And so if students aren't able to interact and create meaning from each other, then they're going to be challenged when they come into the real world workplace, because it is global, it is flat, and they're going to be working with folks from across the world to solve the issues that we confront as a nation and as a world. And so what that looks like, specifically through the IB Middle Years program, is that students engage in a unit of study where they're formulating questions that they will then answer by the end of the unit in a real-world issue, in a real-world way. So they're taking the content standards that Minnesota has prioritized and said, these are the standards that every student should achieve. And then they've said, so how does this relate to the real world? And we're unpacking that curriculum in a real-world context for our students that builds from the assets they bring from their cultural perspective. And those are celebrated and acknowledged in their classes. Is that...
I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Bass, just a real quick question.
I'm not sure if that's still on.
Sorry. Just a real quick question. What is your enrollment here, and what is your average class size?
The enrollment when I started 3 years ago was 450 students. The average class size ranged from 22 to 25, so we do have a smaller class size. With the extended conversation on the closing of the school, we currently sit at about 330 students, and our average class size is 20 today, as we've lost a number of students, even in the school year, because of the threat of school closing. A number of families have left us because they're very concerned about transition. Again, a number of our students come to Crosswinds looking for a safe learning environment, and with the threat of that being pulled, families were quickly doing research and trying to find other alternatives so that they could expedite when that transition came, because for some of our students, they become focused on the transition and not on their education. And so some parents made some decisions that were best for their families to move their students early.
Are there other questions? Other questions from committee members? If not, then we're going to break a little bit early, and then what I'll do is when we come back, we will hear from parents and students in the school, and perhaps Principal Bass, you can introduce them at that time. So members, let me explain what we're going to do, and actually we probably need some help from you as well in terms of where folks should be going. So, under house rules, the way this works is that we individually pay for the lunch. That gets reimbursed in a per diem. And I take it you've got someone that can collect that from members. I think we can provide refreshments at like a small level. I don't know if we've done that or not. And so perhaps you can just explain to members where to go and who to see. And then we'll aim to be back here at about, so very short, about a quarter to, and then I'll give us about 5 minutes to settle in, and then we'll start it again with the testimony. So, Mr. Bass, if you can just explain where we're going and how we're doing this.
Sure. So, the cost is $875, and you can hand it off to me, and then I will pass that to the appropriate person. What we'll do is, there is a buffet, there's a taco bar here in this room to and Mr. Celeste is over for us, and then there is seating over here on this side, so if you want to come in, grab your plate, and you can come back around, and there are tables there for you to eat. Also, restrooms, if you need to use a restroom, you'll just come out and turn to your right, and there are restrooms down the hallway there. So thank you. Enjoy your lunch.
Thank you. So members, we'll move relatively quickly, and we'll be back here in about 15 minutes. So until then, we're recessed. Thank you. I really appreciate being able to move it along quickly. So I appreciate the diligence, members, and quickly grabbing your lunch, eating it, and sharing with one another. Just so the public knows, legislators are very skilled individuals. We know how to do that really well. We know how to eat and run and connect and do all sorts of things all at the same time. So thank you all for reconvening quickly in the audience as well. So the next part of today's testimony will involve hearing from parents and students from the Crosswind School. And then we're going to move into a similar interaction with community members from the Barambig School. And Principal Bass, I'm going to have you basically direct this portion of the testimony. We'll try to have some time for some questions. We won't do super long questions, but you know, two or three questions, and then we'll move on to the next group as well. So, Principal Bass.
Sure, we have two parents. Our first parent is Tammy Bain Kusmarski. Next, we have Kelly DeBrine. And then we have three students from your right to left, Sam Larson, 10th grade student, Nate Celeste, 10th grade student, and Juan Jimenez, 10th grade student, who is an international exchange student from Colombia, who's with us this morning. All right.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. That's just sort of our you know, so you all know when you start off. You state your name, and that gets your we record that in our reports and our recordings here, and then offer your testimony. So thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tammy Bain Kusmarski. My formative school years were in the late 60s and early 80s. The first 6 years of my life were experienced through military schooling, as my father was in the Air Force. Those experiences were in Wisconsin and Illinois. Integration at the military schools I was privileged to attend was never an issue. Then my family moved to Minnesota in 1974. I went from a melting pot of cultures and nationalities to be one of the two persons of color in my new elementary school, which had just opened up. I quickly learned that Minnesota nice wasn't always really nice. It started with the assumption my new teacher made by asking if I needed help after I had so quickly finished all my placement testing in what seemed to him to be an impossible speed for someone of color from down south. Junior high brought more kids of color to the neighborhood school through busing. This was the solution to diversity in St. Paul at the time. The only problem is many of the students who were bused across from town would have rather remained in their neighborhood school. As a result, a large amount of these students were disruptive in the classroom and exhibited violence towards others who were not bused in, but of their same race. This is not the model of integration we want to replicate.
Sorry. All right.
My daughter is now at Crosswinds. My formative years in high school were a bit better. I have to say in junior high there were times because of the bullying, I wouldn't go to the last day of school. My parents sent me to school to participate in school and to learn, and other students weren't necessarily there for those reasons.
My daughter has been at Crosswinds and has experienced a lot of cross-cultural incentives that she probably would not have experienced had she attended the neighborhood school or through the school lottery system. And this has been invaluable in watching my daughter develop. I encourage you to really look at this program. I think it's a model program. I think it's one that nurtures growth through students. My daughter, Megan, has been here since seventh grade. She's now in 10th grade. And so that's where the school stops. But this is important enough to me to ask that you keep the school open so other kids have this as a choice. We live in a neighborhood that is kind of diverse, but the majority of our neighbors, and it's a St. Paul neighborhood, and the section we've chosen is pretty affluent, but most of the parents there do not send their kids to neighborhood schools. They either send them out of district or with school choice, they're not the direct neighborhood school. There have been some changes in St. Paul now where lines have been divided, and it looks like it's going to be the same situation that I grew up with. And so keeping this as an option for kids that don't fit that model, that don't want to be bullied, that need the safety piece, which my daughter has been able to have at the school, has been my ultimate goal. Not only the safety, but the art piece. And through art, my daughter has tried different modes of art, be it band or theater. And from that, her outside curricular activities have excelled as well, because she carries on the legacy of art through her dance. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I'm going to real quickly, I want to go back to something that I asked Principal Bass earlier, because I was struck by your comment earlier about your first experience as a student in what is a, quote, bad integration plan. Mr. Bass said that part of the power of the design here is that there's an intentionality to the interaction of students. Was that missing or lacking in your experience when you were experiencing an integrated busing situation, that there was not an intentional effort to have students interact with one another across race and culture?
I think probably the hardest part was the students that were bused in. There were a few of us minorities that lived in the area. The students that were bused in were taken from their home district where they would have rather been. I'm not sure how the politics came into play there, but you could tell they weren't there necessarily to contribute positively. And that's unfortunate because that's their education as well.
So the issue of choice, those students and parents were not actively choosing that particular learning environment.
That's the feeling I got.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Ms. Devine, is that correct?
Kelly DeBrine.
DeBrine, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee. I just want to share a little bit of my background. I went through the Little Rock Public School systems between 1975 and 1983, and I graduated from Little Rock Central High 26 years after the 9 black students had been turned away and the schools were closed and all of that turmoil. In my junior year, 60 Minutes came to do a piece on the school to show how much progress we had made, and there was a lot of collective amnesia at the time, and that's something that I think that I'm afraid of now, is that we're having a lot of collective amnesia about the need for integration as one of the ways that we can build community amongst the different communities that we have in our state. I found Crosswinds by accident, and I want to tell you, I think, what are the valuable things that they do here that would extend into policy as far as integration moving forward in the state of Minnesota. I come from District 833, and in February, I think probably you all might be aware, there was an event where Some student at East Ridge had read a controversial poem over the intercom during Black History Month. And I think that that's an example of the kind of community fear and outrage and disruption that happens when you don't have intentional ways of building community and providing cultural context for the students that you are educating in your schools. I thought that was a very unfortunate and thing that happened in my home district, but I chose to send my kids to Crosswinds because there wasn't a whole lot of diversity, acceptance of cultural differences. I mean, one of the t-shirts that my son wore at the elementary school was "Be nice because it's right." So slogans don't get you to that deep engagement and that relationship building. I think Crosswinds, through the arts and the sciences curriculum, they bring the kids' cultural context into everything that they're doing. And that has enriched my children immensely. And I would love for the state to consider policies that strengthen the requirements for how you deliver an integrated an education to an integrated population. I was bused in 1975 out of my home district neighborhood into a school that was majority African American, and I appreciated that experience because I was of the majority, I guess, and my experience was that I got respect and I was treated well. But that was 2 years into the busing, and it was 2 years after learning that you can't just throw them into a school. There was more happening after they had started the experiment with busing. So, I mean, I think integration is more about extending the community, providing cultural context, and Crosswinds has done that really well here through the arts, and I think the arts are part of a crucial part of it because there are so many ways that you can draw kids out into understanding each other's experiences. And so, you know, when we were presented with the opportunity to be governed differently through a state agency, I thought the Purpose Center was probably the best scenario because one of the challenges that we had was this sense of competition amongst the districts for the per pupil dollars. And so the governing board, unfortunately, was not able to shepherd the mission of integration for the students. When we entered the district in 2008, 2009, the school was full. It was almost at 600 students. But when the legislature began to question integration dollars and the superintendents of the school districts in the collaborative were questioning whether the funding was going to continue, that's really when all the discussion started about closing the schools, because they felt like the per pupil dollars, what they were getting, was more important in their home districts, and they should rightly be fighting for their districts. But that's the problem with this governance model, and so I'm hoping that moving forward, integration efforts won't be left to individual districts to decide what they want to do. And hearing that testimony this morning from Mr. Orfield, Representative Orfield, it heartened me that we actually did used to have these conversations and that we used to be committed and believed in and requirements and rules that would alleviate some of the segregation that we have. So that's what I'd like to say. I think it's a valuable model, and if there's a way to inform policy going forward for the state of Minnesota, I hope that this experience can be a learning lab and that the schools can continue.
Thank you, Mr. Bryan. We'll hear a little bit later about governance issues when we have a conversation with some of the EMET administrators. Bienvenido, qué bueno que está aquí con nosotros. Vamos a platicar solamente en español. Bienvenido. Why don't you give us your name and give us your testimony?
My name is Juan Camilo Jimenez. I'm from Colombia, and I'm an exchange student. And what I wanted to say here is that I go in Colombia to the third most expensive school in Colombia. I pay $2,000 a year to get the education that people get here almost for free. The education that Crossman's offered is the same that I received in Colombia. I find this is amazing. I mean, when I got here, my expectations for an American school, I had never seen the Crossman building or how I was going to be treated or the teachers. All I was based on was documentaries about bullying or movies. So my first expectation was go inside and find a metal detector. So the first day I got here, I didn't find a metal detector. I found a bunch of teachers just being grateful to students. You could interact with teachers here at Crosswinds. You can talk to them. They will talk to you like friends. They won't talk to you like an adult would talk to you. They respect you. They see a person in you, not only a student. And I think that's one of the greatest things this school has. Coming here to Crosswinds, I think, has changed my life. This is probably the best school I've ever attempted. And I expected to see a square school when I came here, but just looking from the outside, you can see there's ideas behind the building, behind the people that study here, that teach here. Ms. Romero, she's our teacher. She has never been one day out of school. She has, by now, like 10 weeks, only for sick days. And she's never failed one day to come to school, even when she's sick. She's personally my favorite teacher right now. I don't know what else I can say. My brother, he is also planning on being an exchange student next year. And honestly, he was supposed to come here. I don't know what he's going to do now. No, I don't know what to say anymore. I mean, my whole family brother, the family I live with, he goes to Simley High School in Inver Grove. I can get past through that school every morning on my school bus. And I see every morning a police car outside. I don't know what's the reason. It's probably not even a reason. It's probably just waiting there in case something happens. You don't see that here. I think in all time I've been here, I've only seen a cop car once, and it was probably for a mistake. I don't know. I think that's it, all I have to do.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm here to teach your friend Spanish over there. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good afternoon. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sam Larson. I'm a 10th grader here at Crosswinds. Going to an integration school and specifically Crosswinds has meant a lot to me because for the first years of my education, I went to a very not diverse or integrated school. In my class, there was not a single non-white student. And when I came here, there was a very big change in the fact that suddenly my classmates came from all these different cultures and backgrounds and just areas around Minnesota. And this made it a diverse school. But once I settled in here, the teachers and staff created an environment that was very open and caring. And the fact that everyone here could share with each other and like our backgrounds and our perspectives and where we come from. And then we can learn that from each other and, you know, see it from the other person is what made it an integrated school and what made it so that we could all understand each other. And not only, like, we didn't just learn perspectives from each other, but, like, it made us be able to look at other things and from other people's perspective. And I think that's something that is a part of an integration program that Crosswinds handles so well, and I think it's important for every student to be able to experience and is a big part of being able to develop into a world citizen. Now, I hope that this school can continue and can be a model for other schools to be able to teach that kind of education. Thank you.
Thank you. We're all set. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nate Sluss, and I'm a current 10th grader here at Crosswinds. Crosswinds is a very special school because the staff work to create this integrated environment. As Sam was saying, you know, because of the places we pull from, we are diverse, and that's something that a lot of schools have. But the teachers here really care, and they really work to create an environment, as Sam was saying, that, you know, kids feel comfortable sharing. Juan talked about how teachers treat us as people, not as, like, kids. And that's something that's really helpful in creating this environment. And because we have this environment where we feel like we can share our ideas and kind of the cultures that we come from and the backgrounds that are creating on our ideas, we end up getting a much deeper and in-depth and enriched look at the topics we're learning about. And it really helps us to kind of see the whole topic and not just our angle on the topic. It puts us into, it lets us see multiple perspectives, and, you know, it really pushes us, and I think that's something that's important. And I think programs like what we have here at Crosswinds are something that should be maintained and nurtured and spread throughout the state and even the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or observations from committee members? If not, Juan, Nate, and Sam, thank you for coming, and thank you to both our parents as well. Thank you, Principal Bass. At this point, I'll ask our Harambe testifiers to come forward. And we have Ms. Kathy Greimel, who's principal of the Harambe School. And I have also listed here Jocelyn Stein, who's a parent at Harambe. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani, representatives. For the record, my name is Kathy Griebel, and I am the principal at Harambe Community Cultures Environmental Science School. And like Crosswinds, we're an integration magnet school, and we serve students from St. Paul and many other suburban communities. I had a PowerPoint. I had all kinds of remarks. I know we're on a tight schedule, so I think I'm just going to speak from my heart. Because the students and the parents that you just heard from really said everything that I was going to talk about. I think you'll have at your spots a handout about Harambe, and you can read about our features, the things about our school. Like Crosswinds, we are a year-round school. We serve a very diverse student population. But what I think I want to talk to you about this afternoon is those daily acts of integration. There's been a lot of questions about what does it look like on a day-to-day basis. And you heard Dr. Orfield talk about the physical segregation and the physical integration. And there were questions about, well, what difference does it make once you get inside the school walls? I think we need both. We need those structures of policy and procedure to create those integrated opportunities, but if we don't do anything different within the school walls, we're just going to have segregated schools within the schools. What we see in our schools are those, it's that intangible daily integration and interaction with students, teachers, families that makes the difference. And it is intentional. It's something that we work hard at. It's the water that we swim in every day. And Juan talked about perceptions about American schools. And so this morning, this week at Harambe, we have 10 visitors from South Korea all week, student teachers, that are coming to learn about American schools. And I put a message on our board this morning and asked our students, what would you like our South Korean visitors to know about American schools? And it was fascinating to read their responses. One kindergarten said, white people and black people don't need to fight. That was his response. Another said, we're all friends. Another said, we have cultures that all come together. This is their experience. This is their school. That's what they live every day. And that's what the teachers talk with them about every day. It's something that is intentional and is something that is part of every experience that they have. So that's what an integrated school is. It's one that talks about different cultures. And we have families that come to our school for so many different reasons. They might come for year-round. They might come for environmental science or community cultures, but what keeps them at our school is integration. It's those experiences that they have in that moment that they can't find elsewhere. And we understand that we're not going to desegregate St. Paul and the East Side with two magnet schools. But these are models. You heard the parents talk to you about these models that are extraordinarily successful. And so we need more opportunities for these kinds of experiences for kids and families, not less. So I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about Harambe with you. I'm going to let you hear from one of our parents, and then Chair Mariani, we can stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Griebel. And we have Ms. Jocelyn Steyer. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, and good afternoon. My name is Jocelyn Steyer, and I have a daughter at Harambe and a son and daughter at Crosswinds. My son is moving on from Crosswinds to complete high school at Burbage Arts High School this fall. Crosswinds and Harambe have given our family so much, and I want to talk briefly with you about why I choose integration and the arts for my family. Integration is important to me because I believe it's critical for a growing child to learn about where they fit into the world's picture and how they can best contribute their unique gifts and talents to making the world a better place for all. An integrated educational environment teaches kids these lessons on a daily basis, as Kathy mentioned. Minnesota is becoming a more diverse state, and an integrated educational environment teaches kids to respect that diversity of gifts and talents on a daily basis. I've learned so much from my kids during their time in these amazing schools. My son has been at Crosswinds since sixth grade, and last year we decided to enroll our youngest at Harambe because I wanted her to experience more integration in her school than she was currently getting in our home district. And the year-round schedule allows kids to keep their learning going strong throughout most of the summer, as well as the whole year. This turned out to be a wonderful decision because my fourth grader comes home nearly every day talking about how much she loves the teachers and staff at Harambe. She's challenged and engaged and appreciates that the teachers ask the kids what they want to learn about, taking student input into consideration when developing their teaching plans. My daughter feels heard and part of a community, and that's really important to me. While I received a good education growing up in suburban Minneapolis, it was not truly an integration-focused education, nor was it an arts-focused education. I really want something different for my kids than I had growing up. Harambe and Crosswinds are truly unique for this. Kids learn about why being different is actually a good thing, and they don't feel much pressure to be like everyone else. Their differences are truly embraced and encouraged by the staff and their fellow students. The arts help kids learn positive ways of expressing themselves and discovering their own unique talents. The kids learn about the value of community, and this lesson will serve them wherever they go in life. One of the most fulfilling moments in my life has been recently watching my two Crosswinds kids performing scenes together in the recent Crosswinds production of West Side Story. I watched the play over and over and discovered something new and exciting with each performance with all these young actors, singers, and dancers. It was living testimony of the power of integration in the arts. Many of these kids would never have thought they would take the risk of getting up on that stage to perform in front of their peers, their parents, their teachers, their friends' parents, and members of the community, but they did it, and it was amazing. These kids know they're supported by the Crosswinds staff and their friends. They know it's a safe place to take smart risks that will help them grow and achieve all their potential. This is just one example. The kids are also demonstrating what they've learned and how they've blossomed at literary night, in the artwork you see around the school, in the school's garden, in the 10th graders' personal projects, and in the award-winning orchestra. To see the smiles on their faces at the Cast Party Awards ceremony was priceless. There just aren't words to describe how proud they all were of their accomplishments. This is not an accident, but rather an intentional consequence of the skill and dedication of the staff to the mission of integration and respect. This is a model for other districts. This is something that districts like Enid could learn from partners like Burbage, who have stressed statewide professional development as part of their mission. Burbage
which works with school districts all across the state to share their expertise about integrated arts education. To consider this at the middle school level is truly an exciting proposition for all Minnesotans. The synchronicity between Harambe, Crosswinds, and Purpich is palpable, and that's why we're choosing Purpich for my son to finish his K-12 journey. Purpich weaves integration in naturally through its emphasis on the arts and helping kids to not only discover their gifts and talents, but to hone in on how they can best serve the world and their community after high school. I always knew I wanted to encourage my kids to apply to Purpich, but when I walked into Purpich for the first time, it really hit me that this is where they belong and will thrive the most. Purpich will help complete the integration story that Harambe and Crosswinds have so beautifully begun. One of my greatest hopes is that come fall, I will have a child in each of these remarkable schools. It's my hope for my own kids, but also for the wider community to have a chance to choose an integrated arts-focused education like this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Stein. Ms. Grubb, I'm curious. Actually, both of you spoke about Harambe as a model. You said that it's only two magnet schools, after all, and we're talking, oh my gosh, got to be over 100,000 students in the East Metro school districts. So only two magnet schools. I'll ask this when we interact with you, but representatives as well, but tell us a little bit about whether, I don't want to get you in trouble here, but to what extent have these two magnet schools served as models for surrounding communities? And then a little tougher question is, well, why not just let each individual school district figure this stuff out by themselves?
So those are good questions. I think not enough is in answer to your first question of how much have we been that model. It's interesting that higher ed seems to understand the value that these schools can offer, maybe more than our counterpart districts do. We have terrific partnerships with lots of higher ed institutions who want to place students with us, who want to have visitors come and see our programming. This summer alone, we've had visitors from South Korea, from Saudi Arabia. We had a doctoral group from St. Cloud State. Groups that, in higher ed, they understand that this is reform happening in education, and they see that. It's been a little bit more difficult to figure out how do we bring what we're doing here at Harambe and Crosswinds to our member districts. And we don't pretend to be perfect. We know we don't have all the answers. We're struggling through a lot of the very same challenges that they're struggling with in their communities. How do we address these disparities in outcomes with students? And that's where I think your second question comes into play. No one of us can figure this out alone. This really is about a community working together. And I think that's one of the powerful things about a collaborative is that opportunity to share practices, to talk about successes and failures, to really be those models for one another. And again, we can't be everything about integration for the East Metro, but we can be one of those shining lights that other people could look to. We also have had that opportunity to connect with what's happening in their districts, because there are amazing things happening throughout the East Metro. We just need to be sharing that more. I think Harambe, if you don't know, is a Swahili word that means working together for a common purpose. And we chose that name very purposefully when we named our school, because we feel like that's what we're doing at Harambe. We are working together, not just within our school community, but within our region.
So let me just ask you a softball question, I believe, and perhaps Ms. Stein. So why isn't it just important enough for public policy to simply expect that all our students are just the best at reading, writing, and math? Why isn't that enough? Why is it that you feel that whatever's happening in this school is perhaps as important, or at least important? I mean, obviously, I'm kind of pushing at why this is
even relevant at all. We have great teachers, we have great schools all over, among our member districts that perform well in reading, writing, and math. Why isn't that enough for us as a society?
I think the intentionality that so many of the speakers have talked about why the integration really works and why it helps the kids learn, and the staff and the teachers, as I mentioned, or just, and other speakers have mentioned too, are just really very, very conscientious about that and about really embracing those differences among all the kids, and not just racially, but culturally, and just all the differences that we all bring to the table, and really just leveraging those talents and those gifts that kids have naturally, and seeing how they can really harness them to do the best that they can for their schooling and then beyond also. And that's why I think having the privilege option is so exciting, because privilege really has the ability to take this message out to the whole state. And I think that is just really an exciting proposition for all of us, because I think privilege naturally also has an integration, even though it may not say it in explicitly, I think it's there. I think there is integration in the arts, so I think it's a really exciting opportunity.
Ms. Friedel?
I think something that that we forget is the mutuality of our learning. And oftentimes when we think about integration, we think about we're benefiting kids of color. And my experience is that it's a mutual benefit. We're all benefiting from this. Mr. Bass talked about how flat our world has become, and that we need to be able to connect with people that are different than we are and have those experiences. A former student who's now in high school, she went to Harambe, she went to Crosswinds, she talks about how are we as human beings supposed to get along with people who are different than us if we're never given the opportunity to learn how to do that. And so, yes, reading and writing is important, but we read and write for a purpose, and that's to communicate with people. And if we don't learn how to communicate with someone that has a different experience than we do, then we haven't given kids a true education.
Thank you. Members, questions, thoughts? All right. Well, then, thank you, Ms. Griegel, Ms. Stein, for your wonderful testimony. And now we'll spend the next, 30 minutes. Hold on. Representative Dendy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little slow on the switch here. I apologize.
Quite all right.
I am pondering, particularly given this last panel, but the thread that's been woven throughout today of Chair Marquardt's focus on a 21st century workforce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm intrigued with the thread that has been built here today when I think of Chair Marquardt's focus on building a 21st century workforce. And the question, the last question that you posed about why isn't reading, writing, and arithmetic enough? Why isn't it just the hard skills that are important? But what we increasingly hear from the business community is the soft skills. And that's everything from you gotta, show up with your shirt tucked in, and a few things like that, to a work ethic and an ability to get along with all of your coworkers and get along with all the customers who are coming in the door or that you're reaching out to, depending on your position. And the comfort level with an increasingly diverse America seems to me to be a strategic value, added value, that the students at Harambe and Crosswinds can go into higher education and into the marketplace with. And it was just starting to pull some of the themes we hear in the K-12 Education Finance Committee with the themes that are developing here into a package for me. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, comments, thoughts? Senator Isaacson, I heard you. I sit close enough to you. I heard you mumble in agreement with that.
Sure.
Thank you, Chairman. I have to share that when I was in seventh grade, my family moved out to New York, and I went to a school where in West Fargo, North Dakota, we had one person who wasn't white in the school, and that person had white parents, and so a lot of the cultural changes weren't even relevant for that person at the time. To a school in which I was one of five kids with blonde hair and one of about 14 white kids in a school of about 2,000 African-Americans. And a testament to a couple of things. First of all, having gone to a middle-class school as a poor white kid, I was a horrible student in elementary school and in junior high, and I tested into this school's highest classes. And then once I was there, the experience of integration was very eye-opening, and luckily I had parents that walked me through and made me process what I was experiencing rather than just reacting emotionally or as a victim or whatever. And it forever shaped the way that I see how integration should work now. And this idea of an intentional integration that's going to find its values and how we culturally approach each other beyond just the hard subjects, I think is imperative. It is to sit with your head in the sand to believe that we can continue on the path we are and hopefully expect to have an educated workforce and a successful primary and secondary education system. And so for me, that coupled with some other experiences in going to an alternative high school myself, not by choice necessarily, but allowed me to really see and really want to see this school be an example, and as someone suggested, a light that shines for other schools to see that progress moving forward. And that ties into what Representative Dadden is talking about, because that is going to be part of, not just one part, but part of a bigger symphony that needs to happen of people that want to move us towards a workforce that is going to be successful and competitive on a global level, and preparing kids out of high school, regardless of demographic or socioeconomic segregation that might exist right now, that's just essential. And so that's why my heart and where I'm at with this school and Harambee is making sure that we follow through with those things and provide those opportunities so we can be successful moving forward. I hate it when, as government, we solve problems for right now and we don't solve problems for 10 to 15 years down the road. And that's something I'd like to see us moving towards. Thanks.
Thank you. I think Representative Ward also wants to share.
Thank you. First of all, Representative Mariani, and committee, I'd like to thank you for letting me be a part of this conversation. Some of you may have heard NPR this morning, 9:15, 9:10, when the program started, a conversation about women and technology. And I just want to build a little bit on what some of the students were saying about being respected as individuals. The whole point of the conversation on radio this morning was about how women are not really well represented in technological fields. And why is that? And some person called in and said, women don't really like programming. And one of the responses was, the first programming language was written by a woman. Thank you very much. And that most men started getting into technology, into these technological companies, because they were profitable. They made lots of good money. And they kind of squeezed women out. And now we are at a point where companies that are high-tech companies are 90% men, and those men don't understand because they don't see other women there. They don't see them. Now, women don't like that stuff. Well, that's because they don't see women there, and they only relate to each other generally as white men. Just another example of how we need to change the workforce. And that has to start with kids.
Thank you. Representative Lewis.
Thank you. We talked a little bit in the course here about the question of whether racial integration is what's needed as the focus, or couldn't you just be looking at poverty? And the thing is that in the country as a whole, and especially in Minnesota, race and poverty are bound together. It has historical reasons. It has societal reasons that perpetuate it, and it particularly shows up in housing segregation. And my family was, we participated in open enrollment, but in the reverse manner from what was talked about here. I drove my two of my three kids into St. Paul so they could attend a school on the east side, Nokomis Montessori. There were two other families, and we were able to do that because we could have this three-family carpool, and that does get into some of the difficulties for families. We had to get them there. But they went from a school in which my son was one of five redheads in his first grade classroom to being the only redhead in the school. At the time, his sister was blonde. She went red later. So the only redhead in the school. So that was quite a shift. And there was maybe about, I think it was about 40% free and reduced lunch at the school at the time. Quite a large contingent of students whose parents didn't speak English at home. And so that was a really, really different experience for my kids. And it was terrific. But I think one of the important things there was not just that they were now in a racially integrated school, but they were in an economically integrated school. Because there were kids from all over St. Paul and these three kids from Shoreview and North Oaks, or five kids, excuse me. And that's an opportunity that kids have less and less and less and less now because our development patterns are such that we're creating more economic segregation rather than less. And I think as a result, my kids had an exposure to much more realistic expectations about how the world worked than some of their peers that they went to high school with.
Thank you. At this point, I'm going to ask Bruce Haggerty, Shari Thompson, and Sherry Thompson, and Jared Ward to come forward. And Mr. Haggerty, you are a former member of the UMed Joint Powers Board. Sherry, I keep mixing up your name. Sherry is the Business Services Director for the East Metro Integration District. And Jan Moore is the current superintendent of the East Metro Integration District. And I'll let you decide how the three of you want to proceed with your testimony.
I'd be happy to go first.
You probably want to pull that mic close to you.
Chair Mariani, representatives, committee staff, thank you for the opportunity to participate in this hearing this afternoon. It's also provided me an opportunity to connect with a number of the EMIG staff with whom I had the privilege of working for so many years, and also gave me an opportunity to reconnect with a former South St. Paul School District employee who now, as I'm sure you will find out, graces the halls of the House of Representatives. I'm pleased to see Representative Ward here, and I am also pleased to see her in your house. I served for 12 years as a South St. Paul School Board member from 1999 through 2010. I served as a board member for the East Metro Integration District for 11 of those 12 years and served 10 of those years as either vice chair or chair of the EMIG Board of Directors. South St. Paul was one of the early members to the voluntary integration district that was formed. We were one of the contiguous districts to St. Paul. We were also joined at that time by some voluntary districts who joined the collaborative: Invergrove Heights, Stillwater, Ponomedae. I think were the voluntary participants at that particular time, along with the other districts that were adjacent to or contiguous to the St. Paul district. The joint powers agreement that was drafted by the 10 collaborative members, called for a board to be formed and representatives to that board to be members of the individual member district board of directors. There were also opportunities to select alternatives, and my recollection is that alternative members could at times be district staff members, not required to be board members. But through our long history, it was generally the rule that the EMID representatives were board members from the member districts. We enjoyed a significant period of continuity in our leadership from 2002 up until mid-year 2010 with the marvelous leadership of formerly retired Superintendent Carl Wallstrom, who was coaxed out of retirement for a short assignment that we were able to continue for 9 years of terrific, terrific leadership in the EMID district. Carl implemented some very interesting meeting groups that helped 10 disparate districts with different perspectives, different ambitions, different aims, and 10 different member district superintendents who we can likewise assume had different perspectives, different aims. And so I and Carl helped develop the collaborative into a truly collaborative experience. He devised what simply became known as the Superintendent Steering Committee, which polled 4 superintendents, 3 board members, and staff together to meet on a monthly basis and to truly begin to understand each other on a far more collegial level than was available in a regular board meeting session, so that we began to understand the perspectives of a Roseville. We understand what brought a Stillwater and a Montevita as voluntary members to the collaborative. And he also implemented monthly superintendent meetings with the superintendents so that likewise those 10 superintendents of the member districts were also able to foster a relationship of interaction that wasn't necessarily available to them over that period of time. Things started to change. Things started to change in 2007, 2008. And in change really begins to get woven through the latter years of EMID's history here. We had some situations that were somewhat difficult for the collaborative. We had North St. Paul identified as a district with a racially isolated school, and they were allowed in the legislation to pull out of our collaborative and reorganize as a collaborative district for voluntary integration purposes with other schools that were adjacent to them. Took them a year to find one, but they were able to find Montevita to join them in a collaborative effort in North St. Paul and Montevita now collaborate on integration activities. So we lost 2 very valuable members, members who have been at the table for a long, long time. Interestingly, as North St. Paul pulled out of the collaborative, 94% of the students from District 632 who were enrolled in EMID schools, Harm Bay or Crosswinds, voted with their feet to stay in EMID schools and not return to North St. Paul schools. Again, even if the districts didn't understands the import or impact of open enrollment. The parents and the students understood. They had opportunities to send the children where they chose. These weren't district students. These were state of Minnesota students, and they were free to choose where the student would attend. They chose to remain generally in the East Metro Integration District. We struggled for years trying to make the Crosswinds model work, truly work. Appropriate enrollment, appropriate class sizes. And we did that in a variety of ways. First of them would have been in the mid-2000s. We added two grades. Originally, we were a 6 through 8. We went out on a limb and added 9 and 10. A lot of consternation about that, but we added additional programming here. As recently as 2009, this EMID district ran a task force comprised of administrators, member superintendents, board members, staff, to examine and a further addition to class programming and considered adding 11th and 12th grade. The task force brought forward a recommendation to the board to include 11th and 12th grade programming here and be a conclusion. Up till then, the concept had been it stay in your EMID district until the final 2 years of high school. Then they'd go back to their home districts and be ambassadors of what they had seen here. And while that's a terrific opportunity, what brought those students here as 6th, 7th, and 8th graders and caused them to want to stay here as 9th and 10th graders, if 11 and 12 were available, they were going to stay here and matriculate through EMID schools and not return to member districts. As I said, the task force brought to the board a recommendation to increase 11th and 12th grade class offerings. The board did not act on that. There were insufficient votes to approve that. And that caused a period of time where EMID families now again had to reconsider their choices. If we can't have our students in Crosswinds till the end of their high school career, when do we make the transition? Is the transition correct at 11th grade? Is the transition better made at 9th grade? Lots of factors come into that, including what school you'll find and what is their alignment between middle school and high school. It was certainly disconcerting to see what transpired in 2011 and 2012 when funding of the East Metro programs really became an important element. It strikes all of us, I think, to be ludicrous that we would be operating magnet schools, which clearly these two schools are magnet schools, but we would be absolutely opposed to funding them at a level equal to or greater than some of the member districts' average daily tuition rate. And the budgets were cut substantially, and on a per pupil basis, the funding to EMID schools was less than the funding to any student in any of the member districts. And we're expected to run a magnet program in that fashion. It defies some logic. I'm certainly available and willing to answer any questions, but don't wish to do so at the don't want to continue at the risk of overstaying my time. So I will yield and I'm certainly available for questions.
Very well, thank you. Members, we are scheduled to finish at 2. We were fully aware that there's a 2:15 fire alarm, which had been scheduled, but apparently that's been scheduled because nature is going to give us its own fire alarm, apparently, perhaps around that same time. So what I want to propose is we have another 11 minutes left of this hearing. I want to check in at the 2 o'clock time, finish the testimony before us, and then I want to see where members are at, because what I want to do is propose that we go for another 10, maybe 50 minutes, but no more than 2:15, because I do want to honor the fact that some of you are needing to get to some other places, and we've already had two other members who had other commitments. So I will check in at 2 and see where we're all at. Who's next here? No, I'm sorry, Representative Fisher. Question.
I'll wait with questions.
Okay, all right, very well. Okay. All right, Ms. Thompson.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and committee members. I am the business manager for the East Metro Integration District. I've been with the district for 10 years. As the business manager, I'm going to resist the impulse to share too many numbers, but I would like to just touch on a few things that also align with some of the historical guideline and the involvement of EMID. First of all, thanks to your continued support of integration revenue, our combined 10-member districts will generate about $27 million in integration revenue if you look at all of the districts within the collaborative. And this is just a quick overview. The money does flow to the member districts, and in turn, they forward some of those integration dollars to us. You've heard much about the schools. In addition to the schools, we provide other member services or services to our school districts, to our families there. Currently, in fiscal year, well, the year that we just finished, fiscal year 13, EMID received about $2.2 million in integration of that $27 million. About $2 million went to programming for student programming, professional development, leadership, and about $215,000 of that, or about 10%, was then spent on administration, the administration of the programs. I want to touch quickly on the historical changes that have happened from a financial perspective at EMID. Back in 2003, I start with 2003 because that's when I started, so I guess I didn't think anything before that was important. EMID was receiving $46 per pupil from each of it, from its member districts, $46 for each pupil that are just that the member district served. So not $46, you know, for students that opted for our schools, but $46 for each AMCPU in our member districts. So we generated about $3.6 million annually in integration revenue. In July, in 2007-2008, there were some discussions because we were seeing, or our districts were seeing, their change in demographics and increased needs. Also a decline in enrollment. State funding wasn't keeping up as far as the formula. So again, just that drain that everyone felt on their resources. So at that time, our board opted, we were funding our schools with the traditional backpack money per se, but also included in that backpack money were operating levy dollars that those students generated in their home districts. Those dollars used to follow those kids to our schools in the form of tuition. So in looking at trying to balance the needs of the member districts, what was generated locally, there was some discussion and agreement that that those levy dollars would stay home in the resident district. They wouldn't follow the student. They were local property tax dollars. They would stay with the student. But at that time, it was determined that we would increase the amount of integration revenue that would come to the collaborative. From, you know, $46 to $52 per pupil unit. So it really kind of offset that $800,000 gap that we would be losing in funding for our schools with the loss of the operating levy. So the board did make a decision to help offset that increase in recognizing that we would continue the operation of the magnet schools. Part of that was in discussion with North St. Paul looking to better serve their own needs. The change was made in July 1st of 2008. North St. Paul opted to leave the collaborative a year later on July 1st of 2009. At that same time, Spring Lake Park became a member of our collaborative. The net result there was a loss of about $400,000 in integration revenue. 1 year later, Matamidi left and joined North St. Paul in their collaborative. At that same time, we had Forest Lake join our collaborative. So the offset there actually balanced out the loss the year before of about $400,000. Fast forward to July 1st of 2012, and our board took action to reduce the amount of from $52 per pupil unit to $30 per pupil unit. Again, looking at changing in demographics within their member districts and just the demands that that were being placed as far as serving their own district population. So that was reduced to $30. It was further decided that the integration dollars would no longer be used to support our magnet schools and support the 800 students in the magnet schools, but rather to focus on the 115,000 students throughout the collaborative. So we did make a deliberate shift at that time. As I mentioned, looking at the funding of the schools, it's basically the backpack dollars. The funds are generated by attendance at our schools. However, those dollars flow through the resident school districts. Special ed dollars do flow directly to EMID, and we also receive some federal title dollars. So on average, we're receiving about $5,400 per student. We saw a loss at this time in the change of the funding of about $1.6 million in our school operations. So basically, why did we decide to close the schools? We have the funding challenges. The board had made the determination. Some of our challenges are we don't have that local levy. We have had challenges with enrollment at our secondary grade levels. Much of that can be attributed to some of the uncertainty with integration revenue, the uncertainty about the continuation of the program. Those obviously led to some of our decreases in enrollment. Also, the fact that we are choice schools. There's not a family that doesn't have to take an extra step to come to our schools. We rely heavily on our members to share information about our schools. And given the challenges that we've had in the last couple of years, we haven't been able to accomplish that, which brought us or gave us concern about sustainability into the future.
Members, we're 3 minutes to 2 o'clock. We still have Superintendent Moore to hear from. I think it's going to take more. It should take more than 3 minutes.
Oh, I'll keep it.
So, but I do. I want to be fair. Are we okay staying for another 10 minutes? 12 minutes. So say. You know what? Let me just say 2:15. Will that work? Okay. Wonderful. Then let's. We'll set a hard stop at 2:15, Superintendent.
Okay. I certainly won't be talking for that long, but I will keep it short. But first of all, Chair Mariani and members of the legislature and your staff, I appreciate you so much coming today and to have this forum to talk about integration, not only integration on the East Metro, even though that is what it was the intended purpose. But I think we need to really take a look at the entire state of Minnesota. And I thank all of you so very much for your support of integration revenue that impacted the entire state of Minnesota, not just the metro area. And I say that because I'm a greater Minnesota superintendent who happened to land in the Twin Cities a few years ago as a superintendent here. studies that I did back in the 70s, primarily because I was a psychologist and an administrator close to the White Earth Indian Reservation, lived in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, did a phenomenal study about the graduation rate and how terrible it was in relationship to our white population of students. How our students came from the reservation as eighth graders and then quickly dropped out when they became ninth graders or tenth graders. Why? Because they weren't understood. People didn't understand how to operate with students from the reservation who learned differently. Their frame of reference was different. And I think with working so closely with 34 superintendents in the Northwest Minnesota, we all realized the same thing, that our populations were changing, the diversity was greater, but our success rate for many of those students were pale in relationship to our white students. When I came to the Twin Cities, I was first redesigning a mental health program at Intermediate School District 916 and saw multiple African-American males walking the halls of a few of our schools who were really, it was clear that they were misunderstood for way earlier than when they ended in a special four, level four, federal setting for a special education program. It was an honor to come to the East Metro Integration District as a superintendent. I was impressed by the integration that I did see at Crosswinds and Harambe. It was different than what I had seen in other places where I had been, even though from Duluth, Minnesota to Detroit Lakes, like I said, 40 years being in more greater Minnesota areas and in the metro area. There was isolation. Students sat at different lunch tables. The playground was different, but not at Harambe and Crosswinds. It was much different because they did integrated. They were integrated not only in the classroom, but they were integrated in their free time, their unstructured time. A model from which so many of us could learn from in our other school districts. But what I really want to say is not so much that. It's, first of all, thank you for the integration revenue. But second of all, EMID isn't going away. But I think EMID has a lot to learn. Having been the superintendent for a little over a year, we have seen a distraction by the conversations that we've had about the schools. The funding of the schools, the purpose of the schools, the value of the schools, as it has been articulated in many different ways by our member districts. And certainly everyone is strapped for money. So categorical aid, such as integration funding, is very important to our member districts, which becomes a very important part of they becoming a part of an integration district. But it's more than that. When I have been working this past year with our cultural liaisons, our integration specialists, our curriculum and instruction leaders, and our superintendents, we're finding that we pale in one area, and maybe more than one area, but that's what we've concentrated on is cultural competency. And where do we begin to have the tools that are in everyone's toolbox to systemically change our environments to be environments that understand the rich assets that we have by the diverse populations of students that we serve. We have a lot to learn in the East Metro. I can't speak so much about the Northwest Metro or the West WEMEP, but I can certainly speak to the East Metro in that we need to begin to develop our new normal. Our new normal is now we are no longer talking about the schools because the schools have been repurposed to other owners and other entities, or will be, on July 10th, which is tomorrow. Our school board will decide whether or not Purpose Center for the Arts and EMID will enter into an a contract for operation and management services, which is called an income contract with the state of Minnesota, to have Perpich manage and operate Crosswind's school facility for the 13-14 school year. Should that fail, then Crosswinds will, for a lack of a better term right now, be mothballed. We will pay about $400,000 to have the school maintained with custodians, heat and lights, and we'll have our member services department officed out of Crosswinds. Our member services department, which is, addresses programs and services to the 100,000 students in our 10 member districts, includes professional development, which involves anywhere from state specialists on integration, equity, early childhood, family engagement, career and college readiness, to national level organizations who have experiences and expertise in this area, such as the National Urban Alliance, Beyond Diversity, which has also been a nationwide program that some of our school districts have engaged in. So we'll continue with the professional development. We'll continue with youth services. That's 80% of the revenue that needs to be spent on student contact, and that will be provided through after-school programming, Saturday programs, holiday programs, when school isn't in session, basically, including Saturdays. Engaging in programs that would be tied to academic standards. We would also have students engaged in activities that our metropolitan area assets provide us, such as the Science Museum and other programs likened to that. So having said that, we also need to create a new normal about what does the statute mean for every one of our school districts. The statute is heavily embeds closing the achievement gap, and from what I heard spoken of at hearings was that was a very serious and intentional component of the integration statute, that we need to hold ourselves accountable for how we are moving the dial towards better outcomes, higher graduation rates, better outcomes in reading and math at third grade, and other grades as students move through our systems and attaining those benchmarks. So when I say we have to create our new normal, it is. It's almost as if, I don't want to say we're starting over, but I am saying that we need to redefine who we are as an integration district, and possibly because all of our districts have changed in demographics, they have also had a lot of tremendous work done already in many of our districts with cultural competency, equity, and Roseville is one that's a standout. They are an isolated district, but they stand out as being one who's been very intentional on equity work within their district, and you can feel it and sense it in their culture. And there are other districts that are doing tremendous work as well. But now as a collaborative, we need to look at how we're going to collectively be more cost efficient and effective with the dollars that we have in order to provide the programs and the services that we can, and use best practices across districts' lines in order to embed what's working in some districts and share that with other districts. So we've learned a lot from the discussions that we've had, and we will learn more as we move forward. But we need to be more intentional about looking at the statute and what does that mean for each and every one of us, and how in 2 years, when we meet with the legislature again, when we're looking at those dollars again and advocating for them, what have we done with what we've had? So I thank you very much for the opportunities you've provided us. I thank you very much for you being here today. I'm very sorry for the chaos that we caused during the legislative session due to a lot of discussions about the schools for not having a real well and clear message. But we've learned,
and we will also be better at providing you with the information that you need to provide in the years to come. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent. And of course, it would be remiss for me to say that I've been in the legislature for many years, and typically if there's chaos, we also have a hand in it ourselves as legislators. I was going to ask a question about Rome. I just want to make a very quick observation. One, thank you for lifting up, looking forward, the importance of collaborative work and understanding what that really means. And I want to thank you, Mr. Haverty and Ms. Thompson. You know, basically what I heard was that there were a number of financial decisions that were made. You can pass judgment on a number or the other, but those decisions basically put these schools in a place where they could not be financially run anymore. And yet, we heard from the very beginning from our staff that decisions about these, one, these facilities, because we're state facilities, and two, arguably, you know, in state policy, that we really should be backing ourselves into making those kind of decisions based on financial decisions alone. That there should be a finding that that the program of the buildings are no longer needed for the purpose for which they were constructed. And so for me, I think as a legislator, one of the things that I'll continue to have this conversation going into the throughout the interim and into the next year is how do we get it right in terms of making the kinds of decisions we need to make, not by default, as understandable as they may be, but being very conscious and very straightforward about those decisions based on our judgment of policy. And that could be a shared responsibility, absolutely, between the state and school districts, but that whatever happens to these kind of learning environments and these kind of experiments should really never be done simply because of financial decisions, even though those are part of reality. So where's the evaluation work, et cetera? So we have 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Representative Fisher, I think, has a quick question or comment, and who knows, we might even get to Representative Brighter and Representative Isaac, so you never know.
Get a dream.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be part of this committee meeting today. A couple of things I want to mention is, first of all, as was called up before, is Roseville has done a great job over the years on this. I was honored to have my kids as part of this collaborative when it first opened up. I was originally a citizen representative for the board. I think one of the things is going forward is what we're good at the models, if you look at models going forward, if you would have more citizens acting as a citizen rep, is I think sometimes what happens as you start making the dollar decisions, they start entering in, and it's kind of what we experience in the nonprofit world that I'm in, is that sometimes you start chasing around what's more important, the dollar or taking care of the mission. And that's a difficult position. If you don't have people who are part of the players as part of that discussion, you start losing that. And I think that's one of the things that you have to keep in mind. You're in the same situation as we are in the nonprofit world, so that would be great to keep in there. And I think one of the other things that's very important is the fact that from what I'm hearing, we still need integration, intentional integration going forward. So if the programs aren't being run by EMED and this building were to be mothballed, I think it's very important that another organization come in to continue those efforts, because as was stated in the original message, is that this is what this building was purposed for. It needs to continue. And I think it's very intentional that we do these type of things. Having gone from a unique position from being in my mid-50s and going from a white, male-dominated society, working to a nonprofit where I work with homeless youth, males and females who are predominantly African-American, the culture is much different, and how you interact is things I had to unlearn to be able to effectively work in that method. Is in that environment was very important to be able to hear what was actually going on and be able to help make connections so that these youth could eventually be successful down the road. And I think this is where voluntary integration really helps in these methods, is to give us the tools to be able to, for our kids to have these same tools, so that I'm not, when I went in, I had to learn things to make sure that I could be effective. And I think this is where this kind of work is very important. I would encourage that these kind of programs, intentional integration, continue. And if we've got two schools only on the East Metro area, even though they're being run by others, I think we need to take a look at having more schools that are being run by this. And I guess the question that I have coming in that I heard eventually early on is that $27 million of integration monies come from the state to the school districts. Do the school districts get those only because they're part of the East Metro Integration District, or do they
because I'm seeing yes that they get owned because they're part of it, which raises the question I raised earlier, or the point about it. And I know not all school districts are like this, but I do feel that maybe some of them are more looking at chasing the dollars that come with it than the intentional program that goes along. And that's what I kind of felt in some of the issues that I was dealing with while trying to advocate for the schools for these programs at the legislature.
Professor Breiter.
Well, thank you, Chair Mariani. And I can't possibly say all the thoughts that are on my mind in the next 90 seconds that I might be allotted here.
30.
So I really want to thank everyone for being here, because I feel like a lot of issues have been exposed in a new and unique way, even though the issues have been before us before. The threads that have been created between the data that we started with, the experiences of students and parents in these schools, the more executive perspective on how the work that's done here connects to the work of our other schools, our more, you know, our school districts, and how we really begin to translate. And to me, this has been an issue that many of us have faced for decades. How do we translate successful, isolated experiences, whether they're about intentional integration or continuous progress models or ungraded school environments, how do we translate those to the broader community and bring best practices more effectively, as the superintendent mentioned, to our traditional environments? I think that's a question for all of us, and the issue was raised by a parent earlier about advocating for policies that support, you know, intentional integration or any other out-of-the-box thinking. What are those policies? And I'm not expecting anybody to answer that today, but I think that's the provocative question. How do we create policy at the state level that isn't overly micromanaging, or, you know, governing to a degree where we actually stifle creativity and incentives in districts to solve problems in unique ways, and yet model what we know has been successful around our state? So I think I leave with challenges for more thoughtful approaches to a whole range of policies, and I thank everyone for being here today.
Well, so Isaacson, you get the last word.
Thank you. I'm going to be really brief. The idea that what you guys have presented today has been very helpful for me to understand the process that this came about, and I can see, as I have found in many of the problems we have in our government today, it starts with, I think, poor legislative activity in the previous years, and I think that's what needs to be fixed. I understand why some legislative activity occurred because of the way our budget was at the time, but putting you guys in a position where there wasn't a decision that was a winning decision and not being having a legislature that could possibly respond in a positive way. So as I think in some ways our legislature has created this problem, I can see now legislatively next session, regardless of how that board votes tomorrow, we're going to fix this problem. And so I think that's part of what my goal is. But I certainly hope the board makes the right choice in that situation. But either way, I think in the next session we're going to see some legislation that retools and provides for better financial support for integration. Thank you.
Well said. And, you know, like most things in public policy, these are shared responsibilities. These are not just responsibilities of this school or this integration collaborative, but also of us as a state, both the executive and legislative branch. So I do intend to continue to vet this issue out in the coming months, along with some other issues, and into the interim, or rather into the next session. And I hope to be able to count on your constant interaction with us in a very transparent and public way. I want to thank you all for the time, giving your time, you're giving your best thoughts. Some of you have poured out your heart and your soul as well. I want to express my deep appreciation for that. I want to thank the young people, particularly the parents, for being here. And members, please look for work for me. I have done a bit of vetting with the members toward the end of the session, and I apologize for not getting back to you in terms of what your interest would be in the interim. So I hope to do that very soon, and we'll come up with an intelligent, doable schedule for interim oversight hearings in the fall. So look for that for me. Thank you, each and every one of you, especially those of you who have driven quite a distance to be here. I greatly appreciate it. I don't think our
statewide legislators are often as appreciated as they should be, given the big sacrifices that many of you do in terms of moving large distances, moving yourself and family to be here to attend to the people's work. So thank you very much, members. Thank you. I hope you all stay dry. Whatever precluded that fire alarm, I hope it's not from that drill. I hope that it doesn't become a problem for us on our way home. So with that, members, this committee stands adjourned.